Is it close enough here? Yeah. Okay.
Kia ora, good morning. Welcome to Fringe Radio. I'm Damien. It's the second last day of the Fringe. Saturday the 15th of October. And we've got a good program today. There's only three events tomorrow, so it's winding down. And I'll be having a chat in a minute with Advait, who's performing tonight at the Octagon. Just a quick preview of what's on this morning, in case you're interested. So I believe Stephen Lyon's Improv for Stand-Up workshop has been cancelled due to various reasons. So that won't be going on this morning. So at 1 p.m, Tui Mamaki is doing her Bulgarian Polyphony, the Daughters of Orpheus workshop. I believe that's a workshop. And that is at Just Thrive. It's 3 hours long, $30 or $25. And it's basically, Tui's been to Bulgaria and studied with the choir, the pretty famous choir that used to be called the Bulgarian Female State Choir or something like that when the communism. So she's a specialist in Bulgarian women's polyphony. It's a different way of singing. She was in here last week talking about it, and some people who've been on her workshop say it's really enjoyable, really accessible, and beautiful. You can make beautiful music quite quickly. But this is part three of three workshops, I believe. Anyway, you can book via Event Finder or email tuimamaki@gmail.com if you want to find out more about it. Okay, right, so our first guest this morning is, I know I'm going to pronounce it wrong because you made pronouncing it wrong part of your show.
Sure.
And I guess most New Zealanders probably got no chance of getting it right, so why don't you say it and then I'll see if I can do it.
The way you actually say it is Advait Kirtikar.
Advait Kirtikar?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Oh,
yeah.
And that sounds like an Indian name.
It is Indian, yeah. Marathi, yeah.
Sorry?
Marathi?
Marathi.
Yeah, oh, Maharashtra, in like Mumbai area.
Okay, so, yeah. Right. So, yeah. Were you born in India or you?
I was born in India, yeah. Oh, really? So I came here when I was 8 years old.
Right. So your whole family moved out?
So my dad's side of the family is pretty much all here now. So the first cousins is here.
Cool.
So my mum's side's still there, but yeah.
So where did you grow up?
Upper Hutt.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so.
How was the contrast? I guess you can remember it.
Not too well, but like it was pretty different, yeah.
Did you speak English already? Or?
Yeah, I spoke English pretty fluently because I was an English Hindi school that I went to in India. So yeah,
okay.
It was pretty fluent.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Upper Hutt?
Yeah.
And have you been back to India since you...
Just twice, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just quick holidays. We're about a month or two, so yeah. It's not something too long.
So you've still got lots of family there because your mum's family
is
still over there?
Yeah, all my mum's side is still there, yeah.
Right. I was lucky enough to go to Advait's show last night and... I guess the description, your sort of self-description... I wasn't sure what to expect, I thought it would be much more awkward. I was expecting kind of like that, but it was you flowed really really well. And I was talking to Ryan McGee, I don't know if you know him.
Yeah, I do know.
And he was saying that comedians, it's sort of like they start off with a 10-minute sort of section and they can do a show with that, and then they work up to half an hour, and then an hour is like the holy grail. Once you've got hour, you're kind of... So how long have you been doing hour-long shows?
My first hour-long show was 2019, so yeah, that was sort of 4 years now, so yeah. So,
right.
Yeah.
And what's it like? And so I remember you saying last night you sort of broke it down into four sections.
Yeah, about four sections. It was three sections, like act one, two, three. So, yeah.
Oh, I see, right. Yeah, sorry, three, right. Yeah, and so does that make it easier for you, or is that like a way to help the audience cope, or what?
It's just easier for me to remember. It's like break it down in chunks. This is how I'm doing this chunk. This is going to be doing that chunk, and like I just have sections where I'm talking about certain topics. And, so it helps keep the flow in my head as well, remembering it.
Yeah, because I guess the risk with stand up is interruptions and unexpected interventions from the audience.
Yeah, that can be a little.
And I think last night someone was trying to sort of, I don't know, and you quickly shut that down and just sort of basically said, I don't do audience work.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I can't do it. No, that's part of the autism. I can't interact with people spontaneously as much as most people.
I see. So that's your kind of,
My kryptonite, yeah.
Oh, I see. Like, I'd love to, but I can't.
Yeah, yeah. I want to connect with you, but not right now.
Yeah, and that sort of connection piece is quite an important and interesting part of it, funny part of your show. Like, you know, my love language is silence. I remember that.
Yeah.
It's like, you know. So I guess, and from our conversation on air just before we started, you know, you, it seems like you've kind of owned autism, and you know, you're sort of what's the word? Yeah, owning it and using it and seeing the funny side of it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's what the life dealt me, and I'm just going to use it as what I can, you know?
Like, are there any other autistic comedians, like, who are openly...
They're fun, actually. Like, the reason I found out is because there's a comedian called Nick Gibb. He did a show about his autism, and that's when I first, like, kind of realized that this was a thing that, like, many people can have. Like, he seems like a pretty typical person, but, like, there's certain aspects of his life that, oh, okay. And I started, like, just researching after I watched this show, and oh, this is something I actually have as well. So,
oh,
yeah.
I see. Oh, so yeah. That's how you kind of...
Started my journey. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. Started your journey, right. So, Nick Gibb, where's he from?
I think he's from Palmerston North, but he lives in Auckland right now, so he's... Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, okay, so he incorporates it into a show and talks about it.
Yeah, so his show is called The High Functioning Autistic, and then I went to see that. Oh, this is like an interesting idea, so like, we'll go see what this is about, and then, yeah. Oh, I do that thing. I also do that. And I was like, well, I must be. Well,
can you remember what the things were that kind of clicked with you when you...
The first thing, I guess, was like just... he said, like, people wear the same clothes all the time. And I was like, okay, I do that. That's one of the weird things. I was like, okay, that's weird, but I do that. And, like, you know, difficulty socializing, obviously. Sensitivity to, like, touch and feel. Like, different... Yeah, this is different, yeah. And, like, people, like, just repeating things again and again, like, getting really deep into certain... topics, and you see, so just like a bunch of things like that,
right?
And
sort of almost obsessively, would
yeah,
you say?
Obsessively. That's the word I was looking for. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, growing up as a kid, were you kind of, because some of the autistic kids I've known are like obsessively into, say, dinosaurs or superheroes and things like that?
Yeah,
were you like that?
No, I don't know, like anything super obsessive, like in terms of dinosaurs. Or I mean, I did like cars for a bit, but it's like, I guess it was not, it's pretty typical in terms of kids liking stuff like that, but. The thing I'd really got into was stand-up. Like, that was the first thing I was, like, really obsessed in, like, in university. I just got really, really deep into that. Like, just watching heaps and everything I could. So that
and really
first...
enjoying it,
yeah,
presumably.
Yeah. And then eventually starting my own, trying to do it myself, yeah.
Okay. Because I guess one of the, you know, from what I know about autism, which isn't a lot, one of the things they say about autistic people is that they have trouble reading body language and like, understanding social cues that neurotypical people get.
Yeah,
and so you'd think stand-up would be a terrifying thing to do as an autistic person, where you kind of incorporate that into show, like you're in a room with a bunch of strangers. It's like your worst nightmare.
Yeah,
potentially.
The thing about stand-up though is like it's very prepared. Like you know what you're going to say. It's very prepared. You've tried these jokes out before. You've ordered them. You structured them properly, and you know this was the laugh. This was the laugh. So you can repeat the process of going it over again and again, which is part of autism. Like you enjoy the repetition of it,
right?
So you can get it down to like, okay, this is the order you think to say things in. Right. Also, you can't really see the audience, so it's like, yeah, it's fine. You can't read their body language and stuff,
right? So if there's bright light shining in your face, then you're okay.
Yeah, just hear the laughter. That's enough.
And is it still nerve-wracking for you going on stage? Like, does it freak you out? Or
it
does
freak me out a little bit, but not as much as it used to. Like, I know what I'm going to say. Like, as I've done these jokes before, I know they're working.
Yeah.
It's consistently working before, so
yeah,
I'm not too nervous unless I'm trying, like, a new, completely different bit.
Right.
But yeah, for my show, I'm a little nervous, but you need to be because you're excited for doing the show, but
Okay. So that material, how often do you sort of, I don't know, that's a completed show. Do you kind of refresh that, or do you throw that all? Or do you put that all away and write another show, or how do you kind of do your material?
I kind of bring like my old show. I'd have some parts that I kind of drop and then slowly bring back, and then kind of work old bits out. Like I'm tired of doing it. Like check those out and then add a new bit to it. So I try to make it. So I try to refresh it occasionally, but not very often. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And I was thinking, you know, one of the things I was thinking last night, because I was like, okay, I'm interviewing Advait and Ray O'Leary and Becky Umber this morning, and I was like, all the comedians at Fringe seem to have been about the same age. Like, what's that about? Where are the old comedians? Like, where are the people my age who are funny?
I have no idea.
Yeah, so what happens to them?
I think they just don't do Fringe anymore. They won't do, like, the maybe Comedy Fest or, like, start getting on TV, so start doing writing jobs on TV, so they get into that more. I think the young kids... this is a way to get their audience and build their audience and get themselves out there is by doing Fringe shows. So,
I suppose so, but then if you think about it, okay, how like the comedians sort of my age or, you know, like say older than between like 30 and 60 in New Zealand, you know, there's some famous ones like the guys who do 7 days and, you know, they're obviously a bit older, but my guess is a lot of people fall by the wayside.
Yeah, that happens as well. Like, you start, life happens, right? You can start having kids and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so that helps. It's kind of like, I don't have kids. I'm just like, go do whatever I want when I want to do it, you know?
Yeah. So whereas if you had a family and a regular job, you probably wouldn't have the freedom to do this sort of stuff.
Yeah, you got responsibilities to actually do, you know. Okay, just mess around now.
Yeah, and I was going, when I got home last night, I was like, okay, I need some fresh questions for these comedians. And one was, do comedians make good parents? Like, would being a comedian be kind of consistent with?
I don't know if it's like, there's no like typical good or bad. I think it's just on the spectrum again. Like, everyone, even like non-comedians, can, some of them are really great parents, some of them are not great parents, right? I don't think being a comedian is any
the lifestyle. Yeah. I guess I'm thinking more about the lifestyle, what you said about sort of being a free agent and being able to travel around and that sort of stuff.
I guess, that if you want to sacrifice that, is fine. But I've reading Dave Grohl's book last night, and he was talking about touring a lot, but he makes time for his kids. So he's like, makes time for his kids. He did a show in Perth, Australia, and then the next day he flew all the way to Los Angeles to like be with his kids for his daddy-daughter dance, and then came back to Australia to do another show in Sydney the next day. So like, if you want to make time for your kids, you'll make time for your kids, yeah. Even at the big stage like that.
Right, right.
So you can be a good dad and still tour around, I think.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. I was just thinking we were talking about autism on off air before we came on, and you said you sort of discovered you were autistic when you were about 25.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing, you know, that probably is quite late in life to discover, would you say?
It's pretty late. Usually kids get diagnosed and they're kids like four, less than five, and then like there's a range that there's 25 plus, because some of the traits aren't as prevalent, and when they start showing themselves when they're maybe later in life, that's when my traits started showing themselves, like when I was in a teenager, like kind of going through puberty. That's kind of the stage where in my life I was like, oh, because I'm getting more socially awkward and can't interact with people, mostly girls. I couldn't have, you know, that's really difficult,
right?
So I thought it was just like part of being a teenager. It's like being so I didn't really think about it as autism, and I just thought I was being an awkward teenager. So until in my 20s, I'm like, oh, this is still here. Why has it not moved on? You know? Yeah. And then eventually I watched the show, Nick Gibbs' show, and then
And so you went online and did one of these questionnaires.
Yeah. So just to see, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then I talked to my aunt. She's a teacher. A doctor who deals with autistic kids, and she actually knew that I was autistic. She knew, but I wasn't like so extreme that it was like hindering my school performance. No. So she didn't like really.
You weren't like playing up in class, exactly, or getting into fights, or
And performing well in school, so it wasn't hindering my performance there. So she didn't intervene, I should say.
Right, but, and you were saying that you know that, and you talk about this in the show, the stereotype of autistic people is, you know, they're sort of idiots, well, not idiot savant, but like they have that savant kind of, you know, ability to, and you you describe, you know, the Rain Man is the sort of go-to, isn't it, of you know, autistic character, and you said you're like more like Drizzle Man, which I guess is sort of saying, you know, and probably most or many autistic people are more like you, like they function in the world. There's just certain things that
certain aspects of their life they find difficult.
So what for you, like what are there some things now that I guess, because I'm wondering, was the diagnosis a helpful thing for you to have in your life?
It was definitely helpful to realize what this is, and there's other people like me, so it's not like I'm not just an abnormal person, like very off. So it's like, oh, okay, that's a part of being a person, like some people like this, so you just learn to deal with your traits and you find out your weaknesses and you can kind of work on those that way. So
So you can kind of accommodate it in your life. It's like and you did until you're 25, so so you said you're also studying, you're actually studying actuarial science, which so you know, is that sounds quite is it scientific, is it like, what is it? What actually is it?
So it's insurance and finance risk management. So like, so people who work for insurance companies like figure out their liabilities or pricing for insurance products, like, you know, why your premiums are so high, probably is because of me.
Oh, I see. So you help insurance companies kind of set their premiums and
work out part of risk and that sort of stuff.
I remember I used to work in a school and a student wanted to just only cared about making lots of money. And she's like, what can I study that I will make the most money at?
Yeah.
And she researched it, and actuarial, I don't know if it was actuarial science, but being an actuary was like, you know, like
it's a good paying job.
Yeah.
My parents are, why are you doing comedy? We should just focus on that.
Well, I was going to ask you, like, what, you know, what, Would you consider comedy as your career at the moment?
Oh, no. No, it's a hobby that I'd like to make a career. Oh. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to make a loss on this Fringe Festival, so yeah.
Well, that's what I was thinking last night at the Octagon. You know, it's only a 50-seat theatre and it wasn't full. And I'm thinking, so you've come up from, where do you live?
Wellington, yeah.
Wellington.
Yeah.
And so it's a labour of love.
Yeah, exactly.
A bit like running a Fringe Festival is also a labour of love.
Yeah.
But your aspiration would be to make it into a career if you could?
If I could, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So when did you actually start? When was your first sort of gig?
About 7 years ago I did in Christchurch. I was still studying in Christchurch and I decided to do the Royal Comedy Quiz just to push myself out there.
Mm.
But they'll give me like the extra motivation to do a gig. It's like, oh, it's you make it a competition, like I'll try and win something. So yeah, give me the motivation to actually try it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it went well, obviously.
It went well, yeah, yeah.
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 You're quite, I guess, unusual in comedic terms. In the sense of, you know, you being Indian also, which you incorporate into your show, and that's a source of great humor, that skit where you, or the sketch where you talk about being on The Bachelor and
The dating game,
the dating game, and you know, you're the you're the, what was it, the kind of inside out Oreo or the reverse Oreo or whatever, you're the sort of that self-deprecating humor is quite a big part of it, like it seems like, you know, a sort of being able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah, I've got to keep my ego in check. You know?
One thing I was wondering, and I was asking Becky Umber this last night after we went down to the Fringe After Dark Club, like, where are all the women? Like, most of the comedians at the Fringe are men.
Yeah.
And she is quite, you know, quite unusual. Have you seen her perform?
I've performed a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah. So she's kind of got quite a funny sort of angle on sort of being a woman and particularly plays on her voice and, you know, but do you think in the comedy circuit, do you agree that there aren't that many women doing it?
There aren't as many as men for sure. Yeah. I think it's just, I don't know. Just, they don't have the inclination to make people like, not people laugh, but like have that attention on them in the sense that I'm going to go on stage and get everyone to look at me.
Mm.
I don't know. Maybe just don't have, I don't know what, I'm not a woman, so I can't speak for them. I don't want to say anything crazy on that. Yeah.
True. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a risky subject to talk about, but you know, to say that women aren't as funny as men obviously would be probably not true, but I wonder if there's something quite sort of
I think the typical stand-up humor is more like directed at men, like that's just the how it started was like men doing it, so it's like I guess it's evolved to be like men's comedy style, but I guess as women get into it it'll become more different, like branches of it, like appealing to different people, you know. So I think it started off appealing to men more because men were doing it. So I think that's why it's more men at the stage. But as soon as more women get into it, they'll have their own voices and how their perspective will stand up, and then maybe that'll change. I don't know.
And in terms of audience, would you say it's predominantly men?
No, I'd say it's mixed. Yeah. That way, it's pretty mixed because they'll get the partners always come with them. So but I don't know. Yeah.
What about because I was sort of watching the show and thinking he hasn't sworn yet. There's no swearing in your show.
There's a couple of swears, but I think swearing you can use it, but I try to like not use it too much, just because if you use it too much, you lose its impact. You know, if you use it like very sparingly, that actually has an impact when you use the word. It's like
it's a bit like real life. It's like you know, people who swear a lot, you kind of you tune it out.
Yeah.
So what about tell us? I was talking to Alan McElroy yesterday, and he's got a podcast called Bad Gigs, and he interviews comedians about their worst gig.
Yeah, sure.
And I've had that conversation with a few, Gavin Hewitson, memorably, who did a gig in return for passage on a Blue Bridge ferry, and had a nightmare. And what is there one that stands out for you as a sort of terrible time?
There's a few gigs that stand out. I guess you just trying out new stuff at open mic nights can always go terribly. It's gone very badly sometimes for me. So yeah, that's, and you're just like, you lose the audience and you're trying to bring them back, but oh, there's nothing to do. Just keep digging yourself a hole. Yeah, so I've been in those situations. Yeah.
And what's the sort of, what are you normally looking at? Is it like a 10-minute slot that you get at an open mic?
Yeah, about six to eight minutes.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not too long to bear if it's going badly, but you know, it can still feel it.
Yeah, for sure. And we are talking to Stephen Lyons later on about the Dice show, which he's running tonight down at Fringe After Dark. Are you taking part in that?
No.
Would you take part in that?
No, probably not. Improv is not my thing, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, improv seems like the ultimate in terror.
Yeah, you
know, you've been set a topic by the audience, and you've got, you know, roll the dice to see how long you're doing. We watched it, excuse me, on the first Friday, and I think the woman who they'd got up on stage wasn't actually a comedian, so that was a disadvantage. I think she was just a local person who had guts.
Yeah.
And she got 6 minutes on the word cheers. So okay. Cheers was the topic.
Cheers, yeah, sure. Yeah,
that kind of... And she died after about 6 seconds. And she had 6 minutes to go. And it was brutal.
I couldn't do it. I can improv like a line in the middle of a show or something. Someone, right. Like maybe heckle me or something. I'll improv a line. But I can't do like a scene with improv. It's like the worst thing.
Yeah.
Actually, well, that's one of the worst gigs I had is actually trying to do an improv scene on a panel show. And I was like, oh, it was a bit bad.
Oh.
Well,
on like a panel show on a stage on stage.
Yeah, on stage. You're just like doing a panel show. It's called "Don't Quit Your Day Job" or something. And then like doing the scene where I'm like a builder or something, and my boss is angry at me or something. Like that. And I was like, oh, this is too much for me. I can't. This feels weird. I can't do this. Oh God, please help me. I'm dying.
Okay, and so you died on stage that day.
I think I died a horrible death on stage.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I forgot what I was going to ask you now. Let me look at my list. That's what I was going to say. So I noticed at your show and Ray O'Leary riffing. I don't know if it's the right technical term, but like, you know, you took that idea with tomatoes.
Sure.
That I remember, like, I can't even remember how it started. It was something to do with someone sending you a photo on a dating profile or something.
So I saw a picture of someone with tomatoes on their dating profile, and I asked them what they'd made with
it. Was that a real story?
Yeah, it was a real story. Oh. Yeah.
Are most of your, whatever you call them, ideas, skits, whatever you call them, are they from real life?
Yeah, generally? So like I'd say 95% of things actually happened to me, and I didn't exaggerate the truth to like make it funny, yeah, so yeah.
Right, yeah. So yeah. That's the key, is it? That's like you take something fairly unpromising. So to me, a photo of someone with tomatoes on a dating site would be, I wouldn't do anything with it.
Yeah.
So what kind of, because what you did with it was you took it to the ridiculous extreme.
Yeah, sure.
Where you kept... I can't remember what the kind of, what's the line where you go back into the joke?
What do you make with those tomatoes?
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And I just like, watching that was so enjoyable. And I guess that's the skill of the comedian. It's like, it's like taking you as far as you possibly can with something. Yeah. And then it's almost to the point when you started saying that line again, everyone's like, no more.
Yeah.
So is that sort of the... Is that because Ray O'Leary does this thing about Koreans can't farm?
Yeah,
have you heard that?
Obviously, last night. Yeah.
Oh, you were there last night. Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I was just like, how could you get that much humor out of a statement like that?
Yeah.
and I also noticed one thing that you guys do. I don't know if you do it so much, but like reincorporate. So you know, go back, like re-reference something that in the show that you've used.
Yeah, there's occasional moments of that. Callbacks, yeah.
Callbacks, yeah. That's call it. Okay.
Technical term for it if you want to use it.
and I guess I've seen comedians who, some comedians seem to encourage hecklers or sort of not rely on hecklers, but they comfortably incorporate them into the show.
Sure.
Whereas you quite clearly...
Can't.
don't. What, have you ever had anyone kind of like push their luck with that? Like heckle you to the point where you became sort of distracted or how do you deal with them?
I mean, usually you can get a line out that's like, okay, I addressed the situation, but I can't, I'm not going to go with this further. That's what you kind of, I have to do. I find a way to make it clear that, okay, I acknowledge what you just said, but that's enough of that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's quite easy to, people will generally kind of take that on board and
yeah, most people
leave you alone.
Yeah, most people don't want to heckle. They don't want to, no one wants to say anything. When they want to make, there's a few people out there who will heckle, but like most people are like,
most people don't want attention drawn to them.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not your, it's not like, I guess to me would be a fear that, you know, someone would try and sort of disrupt the show or hijack the show. It's never happened to you?
Never happened to me, no.
Is that because New Zealand audiences are nice?
I think New Zealand audiences are generally nice, quiet, which is like good in some sense, but they're also like reserved in the sense that they don't laugh as openly as other audiences. So there's a mix of like good and bad aspects of that. Yeah.
So is that in your experience of other audiences like that are more willing to laugh? Have you been in other?
Yeah, I've been to Australia. They're a bit more open with their laughter. So.
Oh, okay.
And America, I did a couple of open mics, and they were quite big laughers. So yeah, and you can get Americans like sometimes come to shows, and you can tell that. Okay, they're from somewhere else, because they're a lot bigger laughing.
Oh.
Then New Zealand people are quite reserved, laid back.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so since you started being a comedian, like, which is 4 years ago?
About 7 years
ago. Oh, 7 years ago. Sorry, you said that. You've travelled, you've been to the States, you've been overseas?
I mean, that was just like a holiday. I just did some open mic as well. I was on holiday, but I wasn't doing comedy for the Yeah, wasn't
that the reason for being there? Yeah. Oh, I see. So I guess that's a good thing about being a comedian is you just turn up and all you need is a mic.
Yeah.
So do you kind of how do you sort of organize yourself? Do you go to fringes and join sort of comedy competitions still? Do you still do those competitions or?
No, I'm past that stage, hopefully.
Right.
I'm not a raw comedian anymore, thankfully.
Right.
Yeah, disqualified myself. I'm good enough to not. I moved up a tier, I guess.
So what's your next sort of, what's the next thing to do as a, like in terms of your career? Like, because Ryan McGee was saying, you go 10 minutes, half an hour, get an agent.
Get an agent. I don't have an agent. If anyone needs.
And he said it's hard to get an agent in New Zealand. It's like
I think it is, but yeah, I've never tried. I think in Wellington. I live in Wellington, so the industry's not really there in Wellington as much as if you want to get agents, it's like go to Auckland. That's where the TV is, so they'll help you in that sense. So
and there's enough of a scene in Wellington that you can get regular gigs and sort of not become overexposed. How do you kind of gauge that?
Oh, I've never thought about overexposing myself.
You've never worried about that?
No, that hasn't been a concern of mine yet. So,
what's the smallest audience you've ever performed to?
Smallest audience, 2 people. I did a show, an open mic to 2 people in New York once.
That really?
Was, yeah.
How was that?
That was all right, yeah. I mean, I killed for the 2 people, I think. Yeah.
Oh.
But it's a different vibe when you're killing for 2 people when compared to like, yeah. But the smallest audience I've done, like my show, solo shows to like 6 people. So even like an hour to 6 people, it went pretty well. So they enjoyed themselves.
I heard someone saying that the average audience size at the Edinburgh Festival is 4.
Yeah,
the average audience size. Yeah. So I guess anything over 4 is good.
Yeah.
So last night was okay for you? Like
in terms of that was pretty good, yeah.
Good audience. Yeah. Okay, so you've got one more show today, which is also at the Octagon Theatre. At 6:30 p.m. and tickets are available online. And I had a really good time. I said to some people that I was talking to afterwards, I don't know why, but I wasn't expecting to enjoy it as much as I did. And
that's, I'm not sure how to feel about that.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if that's like a because your description, you don't use your name in your show description, so you don't say, like normally if I go to a comedian. Oh, sorry, it does. There is a picture and it says Advait Kotkar is the Awkward Indian Guy Act.
So that's the title, I guess. Yeah, sure.
The title of the show.
Yeah.
Right. Awkward by Neurology, Indian by Ethnicity, Guy by Anatomy. I mean, I guess it's quite an unusual. I guess you're just kind of. I don't know much about comedy, I really enjoyed it. I'd recommend it. And, that riff on the tomato, because I was thinking actually some have been to some of the stand-ups and I'm like I didn't remember anything about the show. And I guess that's one thing about comedy, it's sort of you don't necessarily remember, you remember laughing and having a good time, but you don't, I guess because it's so rapid fire, maybe.
You gotta keep them on their toes, keep next joke.
So in the moment it's fun, but you don't but then particular bits that stood out, like that tomato thing, was just funny because you just went so far with it, impossibly far. So just to finish up, Advait, who are your kind of heroes in the comedy sort of scene? Who do you love?
My favorite comedian of all time would be Mitch Hedberg. I'm not sure.
That's someone else said Mitch Hedberg, and I looked him up and watched him for a bit, and he just does these quite like just
rapid fire one-liners.
He doesn't he doesn't even. From what I can see, like do a riff, like a tomatoes riff or whatever you call it, and he's passed away now, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. Yeah.
What's about him that's so amazing?
Just like his jokes are hilarious. The way he says things are like really unique. His delivery is like very unique, and the way he delivers it is great. Like, not a typical comic, but he's just like a really very unique stage persona. It's captivating. So it's
And I was thinking about personas and. Presumably, who you are on stage is somewhat true to who you really are as a person.
I mean, it's like a very distilled version of myself. Yeah, sure. It's like distilled down to like the most entertaining I can possibly ever be.
Okay. Sure. Cool. All right. So Mitch Hedberg would be your all-time comedy hero.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you watch a lot of comedy?
Yeah, I do watch a lot of comedy.
You still watch a lot?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. All right. Well, Advait, it's been great to meet you, and I hope tonight you get a good crowd. And have you been to Whangarei before?
No, it's first time in Whangarei. Yeah.
So it's been great to have you, and we were saying you probably the Fringe After Dark's a ideal comedy venue, but the Octagon's not terrible, is it?
It's a nice venue. Yeah, great. Yeah, it's good. Good, it's little space, yes. Nice.
Yeah, yeah, sort of intimate. And I think some stuff on this fringe, the Octagon Theatre isn't the place where it normally does things like stand-up, and so it's been good to put that place on the map a little bit. Cool. All right, so you're heading back to Wellington tomorrow after the show?
Tomorrow morning, yeah.
Cool. All right, well, I'll chuck the playlist back on, and we're going to speak to John Davies next, who's here with the show Te Tupua, The Goblin. So, yeah, thanks for coming in, Advait, and hope tonight goes well.
Cool, thank you.
The devil is a lie, look in the mirror, see the cause. Mary, Mary, quite contrary, lifestyle contradictive. Said you do it for the pleasure, don't care about the business. But I know it ain't my business, so I throw these middle fingers up. We between my ring and index finger, I don't give a fuck. Liar, liar, tell me what it is you trying to be. I listen to your story, but promise you ain't fooling me. Drama, drama, always acting.
Welcome back to Fringe Radio. Hope you enjoyed my interview with Advait, who's doing another show, stand-up show, The Awkward Indian Guy Act, tonight at 6:30. That was a really interesting guy. I love the show and interesting guy to talk to. And so today, after the Bulgarian Polyphony, the Bulgarian Polyphony workshop starts at 1 p.m. I nearly said polygamy, which would have been misleading. And then at 2 p.m., there is an extra show of The Tiny Show at the Octagon Theatre. It isn't in the program, but has been added. And then at 3 p.m., there is another the final performance of Alone, which is an interesting show combining written by Luke. Damn, I've forgotten his second name, but it's an intimate sci-fi drama about feminism, climate change, and David Bowie. And yeah, I'm definitely keen to see that. Sounds really interesting. The Imaginarium's kicking off again today at 3:33. Alan McElroy will be here at 4 with his show Mistaken Identity. And I talked to Alan yesterday, and if you're interested in hearing that interview, you can go on the Beagle Radio website, go to Fringe Radio and look for the podcast from yesterday. So Alan is flying up from Wellington, where he's working, and the show is about him being, or based on the idea that he's been mistaken. There's another Alan McElroy who's an African-American filmmaker, and this Alan McElroy gets inundated with requests for work, and he sets the people tasks to do and basically has a bit of fun with them. And that's tonight at Fringe After Dark at 4 p.m. or this afternoon. And then Black Out of the Golden Age, they're loading in today. They're packing into 116. They've got a show today and a show tomorrow, and they're actually the last show in the festival. So Black Out of the Golden Age is here at 5:30 p.m. at 116. And it is based on the BBC TV series written by Rowan Atkinson, Richard Curtis and Ben Elton, and adapted for the stage by Kiwi playwright Jason Fraser. So there'll be crazy characters, outrageous scenarios, and some terribly cunning plans. And that's $39 full price, $35 concession, and it's a 2.5-hour show. So it's probably good value for money, and if you like Blackadder, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. It looks like a big cast, probably the biggest cast of anything in the Fringe so far. I'm not sure how many people. And then at 5:30, Ready Set have their final show at Whangarei Girls High. That's a koha show, 45 minutes long. Ready Set is a band made up of students from Whangarei Girls and Boys High Schools, and they recently won the Best Songwriter Award at the Smoke Free Rock Quest. 5:30 p.m. the Dice Show returns. So Stephen Lyons is here, and he's got six comedians. They each have a turn. The audience suggests a topic, and then the dice is rolled, and whichever number the dice lands on, that is how long they have to improvise on that topic and be funny. And I was talking with Advait about it, and he said that's his worst nightmare, and I can think it'd probably be my worst nightmare too. So Advait has another show at 6:30 at the Octagon. The show Cameras Don't Lie has been cancelled, unfortunately, so you can cross that one off your list. Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers are on at 7 at the Fringe After Dark, and I went to that last night, and I'm looking forward to having a chat with them this morning. Te Tupua the Goblin is on at the Octagon tonight at 8 p.m, and I'm hoping to talk to John Davies shortly. And then at 8:30 p.m. the Fringe Comedy Finale, and Advait is one of the people in that, and I'm guessing Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers might make an appearance, Stephen Lyons, who else, Alan McElroy. I hope they can persuade him to do a slot. So Advait said he's going to be doing 8 minutes. And then at 8:30 p.m. Stories About My Body has its second show, and Morgana did a show last night, Morgana O'Reilly. And if you haven't seen Stories About My Body, it's very enjoyable and out there and touching and moving and just very personal as well. And then finally tonight at 116, Anthony Crumb, fresh off a plane from Austin, Texas, where he's been doing some, I guess there's maybe a comedy festival there. so he'll be here at 10 p.m. So what a great day. Lots of comedy, some theater, and music, and a singing workshop. Make the most fun today, because next week it's back to slim pickings. Okay, so I'm going to play the I'm going to play the trailer to Te Tupua the Goblin. So obviously it's a visual thing, but hopefully you get a sense of what it's about. So let's try that.
Oh my God, this is yours, you're him, you're here.
Wait, you, give it to me. This is mine.
I had become everything a civilized man despised. A slave under the threat of a beating, forced to prepare a cannibal oven. I entered a kind of hell. Come now, laddie. Step forward into the light. Would you like one of these? They're sweet fruit from the original sin.
So that was the trailer for Te Tupua the Goblin, a solo play written and performed by John Davies. A Scottish lad of 10 is driven into slavery aboard His Majesty's ships circa 1800. After 15 years at sea, he is cast onto the shoreline of Aotearoa and the fight for survival begins. And on the website that I'm looking at, the John Davies website, it says, John Davies is an experienced practitioner in devised theatre, a storyteller and risk taker using minimal props. He relies on raw tools, the voice, the body, the imagination, and the story. And what a well-told story it is. So John's got one show here in Whangarei today at 8 p.m. at the Octagon Theatre. It sounds like a fascinating show. And Matt is going along to review it. So I'm going to be at 116. I won't be able to catch it, but strongly recommend that show. Okay, let's have a song while we see if John's around. And this is Conan Moccasin and Momos.
Thank you.
Okay, good morning. This is Fringe Radio. I'm Damien, and I'm talking to John Davies, who's in Auckland, and John's solo show, Te Tupua, The Goblin, is on tonight at 8 o'clock at the Octagon Theatre. Welcome, John.
You're most welcome yourself, and my greetings to the people of Tai Tokerau. Kia ora.
Thank you. You've probably performed in Whangarei before.
Not actually performed. I've been involved in projects in Whangarei, as a teacher, as a director, assistant director to a production in 1990.
What was that?
But this is my first time I've actually, and I came up with a group of students a couple of years ago when I was running the program at Unitech, and we performed at 161. But now this is the first time I've actually performed myself in Whangarei, so okay. it's a bit of a premiere for me.
Wow. Is this the first... So you wrote this play, the Te Tupua, The Goblin?
Yes, it's my own work.
Right. Have you written many other plays, or is this your first work?
Yes, over the years I have been involved in writing quite a few works. I've done a number of devised works in different situations, so I've always made a contribution in that way. Mm. Most of the other kind of writing of script that I've done has been libretto for opera.
Right. Okay.
So I'm not a conventional playwright in that way, Damien. I've worked in lots of different sorts of areas.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call myself a playwright, but I am a writer, and I turn my hand to projects as needs be.
Right. So where did the idea for Te Tupua come from, John?
Well, it came from my own reading and my fascination with the history of our own country and the early years of contact between European and Maori. And there are so many fascinating stories of men and women who lived as Maori in the early years of the 19th century. Mm. And there are extraordinary tales of men who lived as Maori who were tattooed. They were given moko.
Yep.
They had families. They joined in the full life of the tribe, the iwi that they lived with. There's a very famous man in the north named Jackie Marmon, and he was famously tattooed, and he would thrill and horrify the missionaries with his stories of partaking in notable feasts. And his stories are quite well known in the north. There's an amazing amount of scholarship about these people like Trevor Bentley and so forth, have written extensively and done a lot of research about them. So the story really began. I became fascinated with these men and what happened to them. So what I did is did a large amount of reading, and then I began to pull together a story of a fictional character, but I based it on those actual events. So it comes from a historical record, even though the character I perform is fictional.
Right, and I was wondering, is there the goblin, I guess, is a, I don't know what we'd call it, like a character or an archetype in our kind of culture. Is there something similar in Te Ao Māori?
Well, I think so. Tupua was a word that was used to refer at times to Pākehā, because of the pale appearance and the sort of light-coloured eyes, light-coloured hair, pale skin.
Yeah.
And some of the sort of supernatural ghost-like figures that are part of Te Ao Māori have that kind of pale appearance.
Ah.
And so the word te tupua, tupua, was used at different times in reference to these pale arrivals.
Right. I see. That's interesting. So is it a in Te Ao Māori, is it a sort of negative? Is it a character associated or a mythological being associated with negative energy?
Not as far as I'm aware.
Oh, okay. And so you did all this research, and then how many characters have you developed in the play?
There were 13.
Right.
13.
Wow.
So it's one actor and 13 people. So I begin the story as myself, and I kind of introduce the idea that I've been doing research, and then through a little trick, a little metaphysical trick, the character kind of forces his way into my body and kind of takes over.
Right.
And I won't give too much away because I'm hoping that people are interested enough to come and see the performance. So I become kind of inhabited by him, and he then tells the story. But at times I go back to being myself, as if I was kind of interviewing him and coaxing him into to tell what happened to him. And then towards the end, it becomes clear that there's a tension between the character and myself, and we confront one another and have this kind of argument, a metaphysical argument about the state of his life, because he's a spirit, and yet he's come into this human world, and yet he keeps saying that he must be, well, I won't go into it, because there's this confrontation which then forces the finale and the final dance, which is of a slightly different style than the rest of the play.
Right. Oh, sounds fascinating. And so 13 characters. Do you have a sort of a I don't know, like a costume thing to indicate them, or is it just how do you sort of? It sounds like a lot to. Work with. How do you sort of indicate the transitions?
I change the position of my spine. I change the tone of my voice.
Right.
Hopefully people will be able to follow which character it is. I've given each character a different accent, a different body position, a different attitude. I mean, every character has their own purpose and intention, every character wants a different thing from the situation. So I've done my best to embody those different aspects as I switch from one to the other.
So this performance at Whangarei Fringe Festival is the sort of second, from what I can tell you. Did you debut the show at the Tahi Festival of Solo Performance in Wellington?
Yes, I actually wrote the work quite a few years ago, 15 years ago, and I performed it a couple of times. And then sort of my life changed direction, and I was involved in other things. And and I didn't really perform it. I did it five or six times. And then I really felt a couple of years ago it was time to perform the play again and really give it the opportunity to find its feet. Mm. And I had several bookings, and then COVID came and all those bookings were cancelled. So the first performance in this new iteration was at the Tahi Festival, but we went into red light setting. And so I was unable to travel to Wellington. So I recorded the piece, filmed it, and sent it down, and they released it on their digital platform, which was quite extraordinary because it had 102 viewings, several of them in New York and a couple in Italy.
Wow.
So it was quite amazing. I had to kind of create this digital copy, but in some way it was advantageous to the work because it was seen in other countries, right, which was amazing.
Interesting. And I understand that you had sort of input support from Hari Williams and Piri Rewa. What was their role in developing the piece?
I was a tutor at Unitec for many years. I was the curriculum leader of the acting for stage and screen degree.
Right.
And Hari was the kaumātua there. He was the paiarahi at Unitec.
Uh-huh.
And he was a wonderful man, Hare Williams, and he was involved in a number of projects that I initiated with groups of students, where we would go to different whare and different marae, and he would mentor and support us, tell us extraordinary stories and so forth. And I began to develop these ideas, and I began talking to him about it, and he said that he was really interested and he wanted to support me, and so he did. And I would go to him, I would pester him with different ideas that I had for the script and so forth, and his generosity was extraordinary.
Wow. Is he still with us?
His blessing. Yes, he is. He's very elderly now, but he is. And there have been another number of people. Piri Rewe, my old friend, helped me with the translation and continues to encourage and support me to tell these stories, because part of my mission, in a way, as a performer, is to tell the stories of the 19th century confrontations, which are difficult and not always easy to discuss them in the open light, you know.
No.
And yet I see it as part of my role as a writer and as an actor and as a storyteller in contemporary Aotearoa, that we have the courage to bring these stories to light, because it helps us understand ourselves and it helps us kind of come to terms with what has happened. How it can kind of settle us in the present to a kind of a positive future.
Yeah, and I'm guessing your hope is that, you know, Māori will see the show as well. And have you had much? What sort of audiences have you had?
On the plate, Tamata Kapua Marae and Rotorua, which was a full whare of Ngaiwi Māori, and it was fascinating. There wasn't a lot of comment. A couple of people said things like, well, that was a lot of work, or you did well, would you like a cup of tea?
Right.
But there was one instance, I performed it at the Meteor Theatre in Hamilton, and I was in my dressing room following the performance, and there was a knock on the door, and a whānau Māori, and a young woman said, my mother wants to say something to you. And a kuia, an elderly woman, stepped forward and said, thank you so much for your evocation of the past.
What a beautiful thing to say.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was very moved by that.
Yeah. I guess it's the story set in a time when, you know, I'm guessing numerically, you know, Pākehā were the minority. So these characters that sort of became integrated into Māori life were the minority, and I guess that would that be right? Is that sort of...
Oh yes, most definitely. There were very few, very few here, and of course, when they first came, they were terribly exotic.
Right, I see. Yeah, they were, and I guess their impact until the numbers started to grow, until the, you know, migration started to happen in full force. I suppose it would have been a fascinating thing to do, to become, to be that sort of. I guess they were kind of like, not pioneers exactly, but they were people who were lived and in sort of pre-colonial Māori, you know, Aotearoa.
That's right. That's right. They were. It was a pre-colonial situation, and as you say, the real impact of colonization didn't really come until the 1860s.
Yeah.
And prior to that, you know, up till the time of the treaty, things were okay. I mean, there were tensions, and I think there was a growing awareness amongst Māori that the world had changed forever, and there was an uncertainty as to what was going to happen. Come the 1860s, it became pretty clear what was going to happen. But prior to that, there was quite a lot of profitable and mutually beneficial interaction. But then, and then the treaty grew out of that. The treaty grew out of a desire from both parties to settle and create a circumstance that would be beneficial for both iwi Māori and the colonizers. Then, of course, the treaty would be not something that the colonizers felt bound by. They had no trouble at all to violate and transgress the the treaty. And so all of the things that they said the treaty guard and protect proved to be a lie. It's what happened from the 1860s.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, what a question I would have is sort of, what gives you hope? Do you feel like there's, do you feel it's like there's still a hopeful conversation about the treaty in New Zealand?
Yes, I definitely do. Mm. And I think that it's something that Māori are very familiar with, but Pākehā have yet to really embrace and understand the treaty.
Mm.
Because Pākehā have obligations and rights under the treaty. And the kaupapa of the treaty grew from a very a place of humanity, you know.
Mm.
The treaty was drafted by the colonial office,
mm.
and there were very influential people in the colonial office at that time who were inspired by humanitarian ideals.
Mm.
And they could see what was going to happen.
Mm.
They knew that the New Zealand Company and other such land-grabbing organizations
mm.
were getting themselves ready to go to New Zealand and to get everything they could mm. and to undertake the whole colonization exercise.
Mm.
And they saw the last-ditch effort to provide some kind of legal framework of protection.
Mm.
And so it was that spirit. Mm. And then we know, of course, what happened. As I
said, so it came out of a sort of respect for, you know, Māori
yes.
culture and society, and it was a highly organized and structured society, wasn't it?
Yes, most definitely.
Mm.
Definitely very coherent mm. and very intact with all their philosophical and mm. cosmological concepts and mm. everything, of course. Mm. Yes, absolutely.
And
it was very interesting. Henry Williams, who, of course, was involved with the treaty very mm. much, he had been in Wellington down in Pōneke
mm.
prior to the signing of the treaty. And down there, the New Zealand Company was getting underway. And he was horrified because he mm. could see exactly what was going to happen. Mm. So he hurried home to Waitangi, and Hobson arrived with the draft of the treaty. He was very eager to see it written and signed and legalized
mm.
as soon as possible, because he'd just been in Wellington and he could see what was happening and he mm. knew what was coming.
Mm. Right, and it's also, you said that this is that it's, you know, well documented, these original sort of early Pākehā characters who became part of Māori society. I wouldn't have expected that to be. Was it documented at the time, or how did that happen? How did that process happen?
The Jackie Marmon was well known to missionaries, and they documented their interactions with him.
Mm.
There's another man named John Rutherford who actually went back to England, and he told his story on board ship as he made that journey, which was documented.
Right.
And there are drawings of him, and his body is covered with tattoo, and he has a moko.
Yeah.
And he returned to England and took part in a traveling lives are documented.
Mm.
I think the story of the colonization of Aotearoa
mm.
is one of the documented stories of colonization on the globe. The research has been extraordinary. I mean, we've been inspired and led by our academics, you know,
mm.
people like Dame Anne Salmond and mm. Jamie Bentley, and there are several who have done incredible research. And we owe a great deal to these people. Mm. You know, the research began being published sort of 40 years ago, mm. And continues. There continues to be more research going on.
Mm.
Vincent O'Sullivan, his extraordinary work in recent years,
mm.
The story of the war in the Waikato,
mm.
is incredible documentation,
mm.
and not only of the newspapers at the time, also the oral accounts of tangata whenua, all mm. those now are drawn into these histories. So
mm.
there's an extraordinary amount of information. So yeah. I have a great positivity and encouragement, I think, for the new curriculum in our high
mm.
schools,
mm-hmm.
because there is such an incredible body of research that exists, right. you know.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, it's been really interesting talking to you, John. Unfortunately, we've got to wrap it up because I've got someone else who's waiting to come in.
Of course, yes.
It's been great talking to you, and it sounds like a fascinating show. And we look forward to welcoming you to Fringe and Octagon Theatre, which I think will be a great space for this show. And yeah, I look forward to my friend Matt Keane is going to be reviewing it, and I'm looking forward to. Unfortunately, I won't be able to attend myself, but we're really glad to have you at Whangarei Fringe Festival 2022. So I guess you'll be travelling up this afternoon, and I wish you all the best for tonight.
Kia ora, Damien. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you.
Yes.
Welcome back to Fringe Radio, and we're here till midday. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Advait Kartikar. I think I said it right. He trained me up this morning from 9 till 9.30, and I saw his show last night at the Octagon Theatre, and I really enjoyed it. I said to Advait, it came out wrong. I said, I enjoyed it much more than I thought it was going to. And he was like, oh, I'll take that as a compliment. And then I've just been talking to John Davies about the show that he's doing tonight at the Octagon Theatre, which is Te Tupua. And if you'd like to hear those interviews, you can just go to the beagleradio.co.nz and go to Fringe Radio, and the podcast will be there at the end of the show. Very pleased to welcome, well, not back to the studio, because Stephen hasn't been here before. Last time we talked on the phone.
I know, it was very impersonal. I'm so sorry.
It's really not the same. And I could really do with a studio engineer, because some of the phone calls I've had have been disasters technically. But anyway, it's nice to have you here in person. Welcome back.
I'm in Whangarei!
Yeah, you're back. I mean, you're probably the only person who's come back. Everyone else.
That makes it sound so terrible.
I know.
Everyone else disappears. Everyone we don't know what happens.
Yeah.
When they leave town, they just stop existing.
They come and do their gig, and then they bugger off. But you've come back.
Well, I was very lucky because I get to do the Dice Show's bookending the festival. So
yeah.
We were opening night, and now we're doing our last show tonight.
Great. So. And was that deliberate? Was that like a deliberate thing, or was it just how it worked out?
I hope so. Yeah, so when we talked to the Fringe, and they set us up so that it's great for us too, because what it means is that the Dice Show is six of us, so it's an ensemble that comes in. Mm. And what it means is that some of the ensemble were up in the first week, some of the ensemble are up in the third week.
Yeah.
And so the show that we're doing tonight is myself and Ed Amon are the only people from the first week who are back.
Is Ed the guy from Pakistan?
Yeah, yep.
Oh, so he hasn't actually done a solo show.
No, no, he's hanging with the Dice Show.
Oh,
so
great.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I really enjoyed him in the Dice Show that I saw on Friday the 30th. His flights of surrealism.
I love Ed so much. It is so... And the thing is, the best thing that I love about Ed and the Dice Show is that is not remotely what his stand-up is like.
Oh, really?
It's completely different.
What's his stand-up like?
His stand-up is, you know, is hilarious. It's amazing. Mm. Actually, go and check out the comedy mixtape on TV3. It's on 3 Demand. Uh-huh. You'll find Ed in there, as well as one of the other performers from tonight, Bailey Pooching. So, but
okay.
Ed's normal stand-up is, you know, more... set up punchline, the Dice Show that you saw, he told a beautiful surreal story about wooing his Disney princess nurse wife.
Yeah, it was a joy. And I was thinking, so I saw Advait last night and then I went down to see Ray O'Leary and Becky Umber at Fringe After Dark, and I kind of realized actually what's so enjoyable about stand-up is when a comedian will, I don't know if riff is the right word, but like take one idea and take it to the as far as it's possible to go and beyond. And Advait did that last night with the, he's got this thing about, he's on a dating site and there's this picture of a woman with some tomatoes. And it was like quite unpromising starting point. And honestly, he kept going with it to the point where we're almost going, no more. We can't take anymore.
It's too far.
And then Ray O'Leary did the same thing with Koreans Can't Farm last night.
Okay.
Were you there?
No, I wasn't. Oh. But I do appreciate, like, out of context, how concerning that is as a statement.
Well, he prefaced it by saying, you know, talking about racism and you know, old people. And it was a beautiful... apparently, it's a callback, Advait, you know, when you reincorporate something.
Yeah, yep.
He did that beautifully and just took us on this journey about the racist implications of the statement, Koreans can't farm, which is, like, the most... And I was just sitting there thinking that's what's so enjoyable. You're kind of being taken on this journey, an unexpected journey, and I was crying with laughter. It was great. So you've got Ed, and you'll be on stage doing your. So it's a 6-person show. Each person gets a slot to where the dice is rolled, and if they're unlucky, they get 6 minutes, and if they're lucky, they get one. Is that how it works?
The thing I love about the Dice Show is, so we get a subject from the audience, and then they have to roll that dice. The dice defines how many minutes of stand-up you get to perform.
Mm.
And there's no good number in there, because 1 minute is not a blessing. We love doing stand-up.
Oh, okay, right.
But it's also very hard because you have to be funny in 1 minute or you're going to sit back down and everyone's going to go, ooh, what happened?
Yeah.
And 6 minutes, oh, 6 minutes is, people write their 6 minutes of stand-up as like that's their first big task.
Uh-huh.
So for us to go, no, that's just tonight. That's it. You've got right now. You've got about 3 seconds before, oh, no, you're on. Here we go. And so for us, it is, and it does tie back to that heightening thing, is that there is this joy of taking an idea and then coming at it from different angles, heightening it, and trying to explore and expand an idea. And that's what I love about the Dice Show is it doesn't give the performers a chance to censor themselves.
Mm.
So you're going to find some weird stuff that happens in there. You know, there's going to be strange things that come up, but it's also, it happens just in that room. I mean, last time we were here, one of the ensemble members, Sam Smith, this is pre-COVID, but you know, he ended up hugging a bunch of people in the audience to rate how good their hugs were.
As part of his improv.
As part of his stand-up set.
Right.
And you know, like, we often think of stand-up as just being, I'm standing in front of a microphone and I've set up a punchline.
Mm.
And I love the Dice Show because it brings it back into the room and lets you go, well, what is this need and what does it want and what is the best way to explore this idea? And the chances of you actually choosing the best way are not that high, because you're right there. It's happening in the moment. There's a timer on the wall. And so it is very exciting tonight. Tonight we actually have 5 of our ensemble members who are up here.
Great.
As well as Oliver Scripps is going to be joining us again.
Right.
Which is very exciting. Yeah. Oliver, thank you so much for putting together Fringe After Dark.
Yeah, it's been great. Oliver was... I hate to say surprisingly funny. I didn't even know he was a comedian. So now my respect for him has grown that he got up there and was quite amusing. And
So what worst case scenario, what if the dice rolled for a minute each time? Would that be a very short show?
No, we have, I mean, the show, I developed the show myself and a comedian, Mike Kevin, who's also an absolutely amazing illustrator. He did all of our posters.
Oh, yeah.
And me and Mike put together the show. And so there's a bunch of structure in there. And the goal behind that is to let the performers just have fun. And so if everyone rolls a minute, then we have stuff in place where things will happen. Tonight, we've only got an hour, so even if everyone rolls a minute, you still end up having fun because we talk in between the sets.
That's right.
We riff, we heighten, we explore,
roast each other a little bit.
Yeah. It's the thing that I always say is like, we're not critiquing the sets.
No,
we're just having fun, and it gives you that chance that when you're improvising stand up, sometimes you say things that don't fully make sense, or you haven't, you know, it's a brilliant observation, but you haven't quite filled it out. So that chat afterwards gives one of your buddies a chance to be like, hey, what did you mean by this? And you're like, oh, you guys, you know.
I see.
It gives me a chance if I end up, you know, saying something weird like, you know, Girl Scout cookies when I'm talking about Girl Guide biscuits, for people to be like, what was that about?
Yeah. So it's not so much to critique, but more to sort of expand a little bit reflect and analyze, but like have a bit more fun with it.
It is, yeah. And so the
like a conversation.
Yeah, and the way that we pitch it is the show is a mixture of stand-up comedy and panel show. And panel shows are not super common in New Zealand. It's a more British concept.
How would you define a panel show?
Panel show, the easiest way to define it is people sitting in a line doing bits.
So it was 7 days a panel show?
Definitely, 100%. Okay. Seven days, very much a panel show. Right. And in fact, Becky Umbers, who's on the show tonight, she's been on 7 days, same as Sam Smith, who's been on 7 days.
Right.
Have You Been Paying Attention is also a panel show. The panel show elements of those shows are very, like you buzz in, or you have an answer, or you have a thing.
Mm.
British-style panel shows tend to be more conversational. And for some people, you know, 7 days, for some of the audience for that, their favorite bits are the conversational chat parts. Yeah. And so for the Dice Show, we wanted more chats. So it's just that chance to heighten things. Or if you're one of the panelists who's hanging out and you see a subject and you're like, oh, that sparks this for me.
Yeah.
Then it's a chance for you to like hang out, pitch some bits, say some jokes in between. And sometimes they land. And then sometimes you're like, ah, what about this? And the audience goes, oh, you clearly thought about that 3 minutes ago and it needed more time.
So I'm wondering because in the Dice Show, there's no editing because it's live comedy.
Mm.
On those panel shows on TV, are they edited somewhat ever?
Yeah. So it depends on what the show is.
Yeah.
I definitely, British panel shows, you know, it's similar to like Whose Line Is It Anyway? Is you'll record for X amount of time and then you'll edit it down for TV.
Right.
And the Dice Show is exactly that. We'll do a full show and then emotionally we'll edit it down to just the good bits. But the great thing I love about the Dice Show is because it has that heightened energy. Mm. It's live, it's happening, it's right there, is any of those moments where it doesn't land, we're all in this together, you know, and you've experienced it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not, some people go, oh, what if they don't succeed? And by getting up and doing comedy, they have succeeded.
Right.
Not all of the bits have to land. And it is that thing of sometimes we can forget that stand-up comedy is a performing art, and people write their scripts and people develop their character. They develop their persona. They develop, you know, and you might have a bit that is long and needs to be a lot shorter, or you'll have a little bit that, oh, we'd love to hear more about.
Right.
And so the panel part gives us a chance to expand that.
Right.
And then being in the moment gives us a chance to actually like relax, lean in and discover and be like, oh, what do I think about things?
Yeah.
Because there can be with stand up, it's our job to connect with the audience, to reveal, you know, hidden truths.
Right.
Like you say, you know, to heighten things to where the audience is like, oh, I want to be on that ride. I want to see where this goes.
Yeah.
And so for me, I love, the thing I love about the Dice Show is we get to see that journey, you know, and it might be a little bit more bumpy than a seamless stand-up show, but wow, it's exciting to be in the room and watching, you know, six people who all know each other, all have each other's back. They're all, you know, like, we're on stage sitting to the side, and the audience does that, you know, that if something's like getting a little weird, they'll look over at us. They'll be like, wait, what's happening? And we're like, this is happening.
I see what you mean. So it's, and it's also one person on stage, you know, there's all the attention and focus is on them, and there's a bit more of a sort of team kind of feel to the dice show. But talking to Advait this morning, you know, he said that would be his worst nightmare, being on a, on the dice show. I said, are you doing it? And he was like, no way in hell. Because he's not, just temperamentally, I guess you've got to have a certain kind of, it sounds like you're quite, you quite enjoyed that, in the moment, pressure, you know, some people's brains would just shut down. And, and at the last dice show, the woman who had on stage, her brain did shut down. It seemed like she just died.
Lauren did great, but it was Lauren's first time ever doing the show.
So she was brave.
And so that's why for us, we often, that's why I love having an ensemble. And then, because the thing is, with the ensemble, we actually, we do do some training, we do exercises, we warm up our brains. So I come from an improv background. I, you know, trained in New Zealand, then I moved to Chicago and performed improv comedy, doing, you know, sketch and characters and all of, you know.
So you trained in improv in New Zealand?
I trained in Auckland for I was in Auckland performing for about 10 years, and then I moved to Chicago and I lived there for 7 years.
Where do you actually train though to do this, to do?
So there's a lot of different for improv comedy there's a lot of different places. For improvised stand-up, it's harder to find.
It's a bit niche.
It is, I know, because I was going to do a workshop on it today, but we didn't have enough signups. Because it's niche. What was I thinking? I'm crazy. I was like, you know what Whangarei needs? It needs the improvised stand-up workshop. And if you're listening and you're like, we do need that, then please drop me an email. I'll come back up. All right.
We actually need a comedy club as well, but I don't know if that's sustainable for a town this size.
That's the hard thing. And that's the crazy thing about New Zealand too, is it's when you talk to people in Auckland, they're like, we only have one dedicated stand-up theater in Auckland. And people go, oh, well, it's a small city. And because, of course, I'm, you know, part American. So for me, I'm like, if you have a town of a few thousand people in America, there'll be a comedy club.
Really?
Because people want to, they love stand-up. But they love the whole concept of stand-up, you know. And in America, it's a lot more in their DNA. And
I think, is that right?
Yeah.
And so a town of this size probably would, a town of Whangarei size probably would have a comedy club if it was in the States?
I've been to one, and it'd be an awesomely weird, it'd be, the one that I'm thinking of is in a small town in Indiana, probably similar size to Whangarei, and it was, there was a steak restaurant, and the steak restaurant closed down. And then they reopened. Half of the steak restaurant is now a bar. The other half is an events room, which is actually their dedicated stand-up comedy club in town.
Right.
So every Friday, Saturday night, that's the place that everyone goes to see stand-up.
Wow. Yeah. And it's well supported in the town? Like people.
Who knows?
Oh. But it exists.
I was there, we had a great time. We had an amazing time.
And talking to you, I remember talking to you before, Fringe, when we had a chat on the phone, and you had a very vivid memory of lots of, I don't know if it's just because you've got a good memory, but of specific things that happened in different dice shows. You could tell me about like a specific, you know, show and a specific event that happened. Is that because it's so memorable to you? Like how does that work?
I have a really bad memory.
Oh.
So but it's a really good memory that's a really bad memory. So my filing system is terrible. I have what's known as trash brain.
Right.
It's not an empty landfill.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big landfill, but you just, if something comes up, so if things are bubbling,
right,
then things will pop up for me and I'll remember specifics. The dice show, it's easy for me to remember stuff because it tends to be, I get to watch it.
Yeah.
If you ask me about sets that I've done in the Dice Show, I can just remember the one that we did the last time I was here.
Right.
I had a friend tell me about one that I did a little bit earlier this year.
Mm.
But because I get to watch people, so I'm enjoying and I get the emotion, mm-hmm. and it is a very heightened emotion when you're watching as part of the panel too, because you just want your friend to succeed.
Yeah.
You're like, I want you to have the best time and I want you to have fun. Mm. And then you're also going, what would be fun for me to talk about in here? So it's a really fun way to interact with it.
Mm.
But I mean, I've done, thousands of improv shows, and I can't tell you what most of them are.
Right.
But every now and then, like, I had a guy come up to me and he was like, "Oh, mate, I saw you do an improv show. You did that chicken sketch." I'm just like, when was this? He's like, it was about 6 or 7 years ago. Oh. I'm like,
Right, that's funny.
But that's what I love about improv is it's disposable, you know, mm-hmm. it's ephemeral. It just exists in that moment, and we're all there for it.
Mm-hmm.
And people, performers in the Dice Show have taken stuff that they've improvised and actually scripted it up and expanded it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
it could generate some new material if you're...
Oh, 100%. I think most of the people who have done the show more than once have taken a few little bits out of it where they're like, oh, this would be really fun to work on.
Mm. And I wonder if someone like Ed, you know, that really great thing he did with the Disney princess nurse thing, you know, that's potentially, I mean, it was hilarious in the moment. I don't know how material, because I was talking to Advait, how do you know that something's got potential? Like, what's the kind of, I guess until you play with it, you don't, or?
Well, I think that's tragically for us, that comes down to time, experience, and also taste, you know? And I can say that as someone who doesn't have great taste. You know,
oh, really?
Like for me, me, when I write, I'm just like, is this good?
Mm.
Most of the stuff that I, my scripted stand-up is, most of it is, I write a joke down, I'll perform it to an audience, the audience will go, eh.
Yeah.
And then in the moment, I'll go, oh no, I need to give them a good time. And then my improv brain will fix the joke.
Right.
And then I go back and just delete the middle part because it didn't work.
Literally on stage that happens.
Yeah. That's but that's because I'm still very much learning as a stand-up comedian. I haven't been doing it that long. It's a very different skill to stage improvisation.
Mm.
But then there's other people who, as soon as they write something down, they'll know.
Mm.
You know, and mm-hmm. they will, and that, those are the people who generally, when you see them on stage, you'll fall in love with them because they know what they find funny and they know how to sell that to people.
Right. Okay.
Oh, hello. Oh, sorry.
Oh, hello.
Hi. We're doing a radio show.
You're on the radio now.
And it's 28 minutes past 10, so Becky and Ray have arrived. So we'll have to wrap this up. So, Stephen, 5:30 p.m. So you've got Alan McElroy on at 4 down at Fringe After Dark. There's some great comedy today. And then the Dice Show Returns is at 5:30 for 1 hour, followed by Advait, who's going to do his Awkward Indian Guy act, but that's at the Octagon Theatre. Should be at Fringe After Dark, but anyway, that's the way it worked out. And then at 7, Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers are doing their All Your Money Back show, half an hour each, which was very enjoyable last night. And then at 8:30, it's the Fringe Comedy Finale. How long will that run for?
Oh, I think about 90 minutes.
Oh, great. So great.
Probably.
And probably every comedian in town will be, I know Advait's doing a set. You'll be doing a set, I guess. Will you be solo set?
I'll be emceeing up a storm. Okay. I also know that Keegan Govind and Itai Bendom are driving up from Auckland.
Oh.
Those are two comedians who you might have seen in the first week. Also, they're both comedians who just had their photos go up on the wall at the Classic in Auckland.
Right.
That's
a significant thing.
Yeah, that's a big deal. There's only so much wall. So if they give any of it to us, we're very excited.
Okay, great. So it's going to be a great final night of Fringe, down at Fringe After Dark. And then also at 10 p.m. here at 116, Anthony Crum is doing a solo show. I think he's fresh off the plane from Austin, Texas.
Yeah, comedian.
You've seen
Crumb
him?
Oh, I love Crumb is amazing. He's an absolute delight. He comes from an improv background, but he is an incredible actor. Some of you may have seen him in The Ring of Power.
Yes, apparently he's
at the moment.
Yeah,
he's incredible in that. Just a beautiful, empathetic performer who is going to make you giggle like crazy.
Awesome. All right, it's lovely the way you guys sort of support each other and have each other's backs.
Oh, no, I mean, everyone's terrible. Come to the Dice Show. Except Becky. Becky's amazing because she's also in the Dice Show.
Ah, and you don't have to... There's no clashes, I don't think, so you're not going to miss... I guess you've either got Advait or Ray O'Leary and Becky because they're on at the same time, but...
The trick is find a friend, get your friend to just throw FaceTime on, pop an earbud in, and you can just watch both shows.
Wow.
It'll be exactly the experience that the performers wanted you to have.
All right, great. Thanks so much for coming in, Stephen. It's been great to have you in the studio, and we will chuck the playlist back on for a second while Ray and Becky take their seats. Good luck with the Dice Show, and thanks for being part of Whangarei Fringe.
Thanks for having me. Get out and see some shows, everyone. Whoop,
welcome back to Fringe Radio. I'm Damien. We're here till 12 and we're having a fantastic morning. We've got Ray O'Leary and Becky Umber in now after Stephen. And I had a great conversation with Advait this morning at 9 and John Davies, who's doing a show, Te Tupua, tonight at the Octagon. So after the show finishes, if you want to listen to any of those interviews, you can just go to the Beagle Radio website and listen to the podcast. So welcome to the studio, Ray and Becky.
Hello.
Have you guys performed in Whangarei before?
A few times at the old Naughty North thing.
A guy who works for Whangarei Fringe used to run a comedy gig.
Oliver Scripps?
Yes, Oliver Scripps. Mm. Yeah, he used to run a great gig. He may still run it, but I've done that a few times, and it's always been great. I really like performing in Whangarei.
Was that at the Butter Factory? Was that where he ran it?
Yeah. I love the Butter Factory.
Yes.
I love performing in the cave.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, the cave, yeah.
Real Fritzel vibe. And then also here at 116, which is a great room as well to perform in.
Oh, you've performed here as well?
Yes,
Okay. Yeah. Do you do anything else like improv or any like stuff like that, or you just do straight stand up?
I do some improv with Stephen.
Oh, you're in the Dice Show tonight?
Dice Show, yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't fill you with terror?
No, it's kind of nice because you're like, well, if this flops, at least I didn't plan it, you know? Like, it's meant to be on the spot, so there's leeway. I'm like,
has it ever flopped? Have you ever just died?
Not in the Dice Show, actually. It's a real nice show, it's real easy and chill and fun. So
and Stephen's like, everyone's got each other's back, so no one's there to take you down.
Yeah.
And last for the beginning of Fringe, they did the Dice Show, and they had a woman on stage who's not a stand-up comedian, and she got 6 minutes on the word cheers. About 6 seconds, she'd run out of ideas, and it was a very long 6 minutes. But everyone else sort of like was throwing stuff at her. But I guess, and talking to Stephen, it takes a certain kind of sort of presence of mind and lack of panic in the moment to be able to deal with that kind of pressure. Yeah. Would
it
you agree?
Is weird. But it's also good for stand-up comedy because you do need to have that presence of mind. I guess if someone yells something out at you, instead of being like, ah!
Yeah. Although I went to see Advait before I came down to see you guys last night, and he makes it quite clear. He's like, I don't do crowd work.
Yes.
So basically, anyone who tries to talk to me is just like, sorry, I don't do crowd work. And he seemed to get away with it. I was like, lucky bastard, because a heckler who wanted to hijack probably could. So how was last night for you?
Good
show.
How do you gauge it? Like, what's your sort of...
I've recorded it. I haven't listened to the recording yet.
Oh. Do you normally record it?
Yeah, I've got a recording of nearly every single time I've performed on stage.
Wow.
And so that way I can go back and listen to it and, you know, see what needs to change or see, you know, see how well it went compared to other times. And, so, yeah, that's the way I work.
Do most comedians do that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I think
a lot of them.
I think definitely, I mean, every comedian, you know, wants to improve and stuff. I don't know if everyone, I have a friend who doesn't record their sets at all and it drives me up the wall. I don't know how he can do it because it's so hard to remember every single line went, how long the laughs were, things like that. You know, you can't get a proper gauge of it. And I like to be quite meticulous with my assessing myself. Like I've got spreadsheets and things like that.
Yeah, he looks like a man who uses Excel.
Yeah,
and you've even incorporated that into the show.
Yeah.
The personality, what was it? The social skills of Excel or something like that. And I was thinking, so I realized last night when I was watching your shows, the joy for me of being taken on a journey, you know, with a comedian like you take us on the Koreans Can't Farm journey.
I'm specifically saying that I think it's wrong to say Koreans.
Yes.
Can't farm.
Oh, yes. I should add that. In. I mean, you set it up very clearly that you know it's an old person saying that, and then you just kept going with it, and it was like, how far can you go with this?
Yes, yeah.
And the challenge, I guess, for you as a comedian is to see how far you can go.
Yes, yeah.
And so did that idea sort of, is that something that you developed or did it come fully formed when you put it in your material, in your show?
I remember when it happened. I think it was my 30th birthday and I met a distant relative I've never met before.
Uh-huh.
And she said that to me. She said
that actually happened.
Yeah. She was talking about the person she had bought her property from, and she said Koreans can't farm. And I just remember thinking that's an insane thing to say. And every person I told people that she had said that to me, and like my friends all laughed that she had said that. And so I was like, oh no, there's something funny here. There's something in the absurdity of what she said.
Yeah.
And so then I just sat down and I tried to think of as many different angles as I could on how to approach it, you know, like, is there a funny way of trying to make it seem like a progressive thing that she said? Is there, I tried to think, you know, what else might she think, you know, things like that. And
yeah.
I was trying to approach it in as many different angles as I could without, my main fear was I didn't want it to come across as a bit that was like, sort of like, oh, all old people are racist or whatever. Which I feel like has been done to death, I think, on stage. I guess I was just trying to approach it as many different ways that were unique.
Yeah, I guess that's the fun of it is that, you know, you're sort of exploring it, and like you say, you can kind of look at it from different angles, and you go, well, what if this, and what if this, and what if she's actually quite a progressive racist, you know? And really, it's quite clear what your position on racism is. You know, you're not taking
I'm pro it.
And I also noticed one thing that you both did was to draw attention to yourselves and your sort of physicality. In your case, where you did that very funny line about some people struggle with their weight. I've never had a problem with it. You know, I've had no problem putting on weight, which is, I guess, a way of, like, you know, doing that. And and Becky, your thing about your voice, which is very sort of, which I guess, you know, you draw attention to it, so you're sort of owning it, a bit like Advait owns autism. You know, he's like, and he incorporates it very amusingly into the show. And so how about you, Becky? That what Ray was saying about getting that idea about the Koreans at farm comes from a real thing.
Yeah.
How about you? How do you?
Yeah,
kind of...
like a lot of the stuff does genuinely happen to me. I'm a bit of a mess, and like there's a bit about where a guy is like, "Why do you talk like that?" And that genuinely happened to me. Like, this voice lends itself to a lot of
Do you get that a lot?
Yeah, I do, and I feel like I do have to acknowledge it within my stand-up. Like, I feel like I'll never do a set where I don't have at least one small joke. Being this is my real voice. Like, it's not a bit. It's not a character. Also, and I do the old heckle where they yell stuff out.
Yeah. You don't exaggerate it at all,
voice? No, this is how it is.
How would you describe it? Like, I know you say a seagull, but which is, you know, you say in the show your spirit animal is a seagull and very amusingly kind of reincorporated, you'll find me by the dustbins, I remember that. Because I was thinking, actually, don't remember much about, you go and see a comedian, you often don't remember a lot about it.
Yeah.
But there are some things, you know, that you do remember, like, for example, you drawing attention to your voice and saying your spirit animal is a seagull and your thing about the Koreans. So what, you know, so you draw on real life, you kind of take things like, is that what most comedians do you think?
It really depends. A lot of people are like observational. I feel like I'm kind of maybe storytelling a little bit.
So how would you categorize them? So there's observational, which is, how do you define that?
Observational, I think, is like, I think I'm a very observational comedian. Like, I mean, I do draw things from my personal life, I guess, but I don't feel like I'm a storyteller. I don't feel like I tell stories about my life. I feel like maybe I make an observation and then I try digging deep into that as I can.
Right.
Or I have an opinion on something and I try to explore that as much as I can.
Mm.
But I guess an observational comedian is sort of, I think, like your... There's like the classic form of a comedian, like Jerry Seinfeld is like...
Yeah. Right.
Is like
airplane food. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you go out and you observe something in the real world.
Yeah.
And then you
point out and how it's, weird it is.
Yeah, exactly. And observational comedy is often like very relatable. You know, you're like Jerry Seinfeld saying, where do my socks go after I've done the washing? You know, like, you know, things like that. You know, then we go, oh yeah, we've all lost our socks. You know, that's I think the classic observational comedy. And then I think there'd be dark comedy, dark humour.
That's a genre of...
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah,
where you're deliberately going into very dark, disturbing, sort of borderline.
Yeah, you talk about death and the more in the darker topics like that. Yeah.
Well, there's a bit of that in your show, your set.
Yes, I'm quite drawn to it. Yes.
Yeah.
I try without. I mean, hopefully, It's not offensive, but I do try. I do find there's a lot of comedy to be mined in dark areas and especially because I try. I try not to swear on stage.
Yeah.
I try.
Notice that you drew attention to the fact you only swore when the show was over.
I try not to swear, and I also try not to talk about sexual stuff on stage as well. It's just a personal preference. I feel every other comic is doing it, and they probably do it better than me.
Right,
And then the other is I feel uncomfortable. Like I'm talking about it sometimes, and like on stage, and like yesterday. So I was on Have You Been Paying Attention last night, a TV show, and my mum messaged me and said, will it be okay for your granddad to watch? And so when you have your like conservative relatives.
Yeah, and that matters to you? You're not out to upset your...
I guess I would be nice. I think one of the things that I think is I would like people to, if they come and see me, I'd like them to not enjoy me for me. You know, I don't want them to have an excuse. I don't want them to go, oh, he swore too much or he was too dirty. I'd like them to just not like me because it's me.
Yeah.
You know, because there are lots of people out there who say things like, oh, comedians swear too much. They're all too dirty. And I do think that is ridiculous. Like, I think it's fine for comedians to swear. It's, you know, I don't have like a moral issue with it. It's just my personal preference.
Right. And are there some, Becky, there's some comedians who you think go too far? Like, are there some people who you just don't like their stuff? You know,
I mean, there is in any kind of form of entertainment.
I suppose.
It's just everyone's personal preference.
Yeah. Who do you like then? Who's a comedian that you like?
Oh God, there's so many. Within New Zealand, a big fan of people like Raymond here. Guy Montgomery, huge fan. Then we've got Mel Bracewell and all those kinds of ones. Then there's all the British ones like James Acaster, Josh Widdicombe, there's just so many. I feel like there's so many comedians at the moment.
And James Acaster's name comes up quite often what is it about him you like?
He's a genius. The fact that he did three Netflix hours.
Four.
Like just to have that much material to burn within and like really good solid hours, all of them.
Yeah.
And
do you watch a lot? Like, do you watch a lot of comedy?
Yeah, I do try to. Yeah.
Do you think that you need to? Does it sort of?
I think it's good to like learn from. Mm. I also just watch it because I love it. I think that's
most both of you agree that.
And I think another benefit is that you watch it and you realize, I can't talk about that anymore, or like, or that punchline's been done. I can't do that now.
Right. Because being original. It's quite important, isn't it? Yes. Like, you've got to have your own sort of take. Otherwise, it's probably quite easy to imitate.
I think so, yes. Yeah. That's always a fear if you like someone too much. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, I better stop watching this stuff.
They're like intonations and stuff.
Yeah.
And Becky, I asked you last night at the club when I saw you in the bar, I've talked to a lot of the comedians who've come up for Fringe, and there aren't many women.
Oh yeah.
What's that about? Is it because women?
I bully them out of the industry.
Is it because they try and get in, and it's just a male-dominated space?
It's
very
male-dominated. I think it's just also something that men are more drawn to because I guess women. I'm making sweeping generalizations here, but there is kind of this notion of there's a lot of confident men out there who are used to being listened to and told they're funny, Whereas there's a lot of women who, you know, there is still that idea that women aren't funny.
Mm.
So I find that the main thing is there's a lot of the ratio of women at the top stays is better than at the bottom. Like there's a whole bunch of people starting comedy, and a lot of the women, you know, for a woman to get confident enough to do it, I think she's usually quite good.
Because of the comedians you named that you like, none of them are women.
Yeah,
I noticed. But yeah, it's just a. So are there
one
any
of them, Mel Bracewell?
Mel Bracewell. Sorry, was a woman, right? I'm not familiar with Mel. So what are the one question I was wondering? What are the careers were you considering other than being a comedian?
Oh God, well, I used to work in copywriting. So I was doing that and juggling it with comedy for a while, and then just chucked it all.
Yes, I briefly for a while I thought I'd become a philosophy lecturer or become an academic, and then for a little bit I was also a policy advisor at the Department of Corrections.
So what did you study in order to be able to do that kind of thing?
I have a master's in philosophy. That's all I did. And my friend got a job at Corrections that I knew, and then she put my CV forward as well. And I got interviewed. I got the job, and I ended up becoming a policy advisor back in this was years ago.
Right.
National government, the last national government was still in when I was when I got the job.
Uh-huh.
And I just hated working 9 to 5. I was very, very bad at it. I'm very lazy. And when I quit that job and I moved to Auckland, and the last job I had, I remember my boss, she said to me, can you please stop coming into work an hour late? And we also notice you're always on Facebook. And I was like, yeah, of course, I'll stop that. And so the next day I handed in my resignation.
So interesting philosophy, because you referenced that in the show last night. You said your favourite book's Harry Potter than the Philosopher's Stone or the Sorcerer's Stone, as they say in America.
I like Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And so when I went to uni, I studied philosophy, or if you're American, sorcery. Yeah.
I spoke to Alexander Sparrow, and he's doing a MA in philosophy as well, I think, about comedy. And there's it's philosophy, but it's, you know, and he said, stand up is my lab.
Yeah.
And he was telling me about all these, you know, other things like insult comedy and superiority theory and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, it's an academic discipline.
Yes. I've read articles, I think, maybe on the ethics of comedy, and the Stanford, this is very boring for anyone who's not a philosophy, but the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is a legitimate academic source for philosophers, for academics, has a whole section on the theories of humour and like why things are funny. And so there's one theory is the superiority idea, the idea that you have to be superior to someone else. There's the incongruity theory, which I think is the one that I prefer.
Milk.
Yeah, where the idea is that the reason why things are funny is you've created an incongruity that, you know, people weren't expecting. I've seen another theory that it's all about benign violations, that you have to make something a violation, but it's also benign and non-threatening. So Seinfeld talks about benign things, but he makes them seem like, you know, violations of the, I don't know, natural world or order or whatever.
Right.
Or there are some people who talk about like extreme, horrible violations, but they make them seem benign, and that's where the comedy lies. There's all sorts of different theories for why things are funny. And
that's fascinating. Yeah. So you studied philosophy up to master's level.
Yes.
And possibly could have been or could still become an academic. Is that something you still consider? Is a possibility?
No, not anymore. No, I stopped doing philosophy because I had a fear of running out of original ideas, and so then I moved to comedy, which has the exact same
problem.
The exact same problem.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess what else was I going to ask you apart from your careers? Where do you get your best ideas? Like when or like what sort of context? Is it unpredictable when something will come to you or?
Yeah, I was just saying to Ray last night, actually, it's so annoying. I feel like I work best when I'm given parameters, you know?
Right,
like
limitations are helpful.
Like someone says, write a presentation about this, and then you've got, and then all of a sudden, in a week, you write 10 minutes. Whereas the rest of the time, I'm just like, when am I going to think of a new joke? And they're just waiting for them to come to me.
But I guess if you're tuned into life in a way that's seeing the potential in things...
Yeah.
Does it come in phases? Like, do you have sort of dry spells where nothing happens, or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What's a good way to kind of stimulate that? Do you ever sort of sit down and think,
Because some people are quite disciplined about it, I would guess, and other people are probably a bit more...
Yes, every time I have an idea come to me, I always, like, write down every idea you have, like, no matter how terrible it is. I've got, you know, notebooks filled with awful ideas and, you know, things that didn't work. Like, one time I was at the dentist and there was a TV up on the ceiling and I thought, oh, no one's talking about that. And so then I thought, maybe I'd try write jokes about that. Turns out not very funny.
Oh, I see. So there's a TV up there for you to watch while they're doing your mouth.
Yeah, so it was something I noticed that lots of dentists had. And I was like, I don't think I've ever seen any stand-up about that. Maybe I should try write jokes. And then, anyway, it didn't work. But that was like, things like that I'll do. Or like.
So lots of dead ends when you...
Yeah. Well, even bits, like I've got probably like 10 bits in a big Google Doc at the minute that I'm like, there's something there, and I've tried to sit down and be like, and write into a joke, and then I just can't figure it out, and I'll just leave it, and one day I'll come back to it, and then sometimes you come back to it, and it just clicks, and then you're like, this is what's funny, this is, and then...
But do you guys have people in your lives who you can kind of, you like, run it past, and sort of go...
Yeah, we run it past each other.
Oh, each other, really?
Yeah, long car rides.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then my flatmate's a comedian, I have other, you've got people in your life, you can run it past, which you need to do, I think, and then to get engaged, you know, to make sure you're not going to make a fool of yourself.
And comedians are quite collaborative like that? Would you feel like it's not so competitive? Yeah. I imagine that you'd be all like kind of like, you know, this is my material.
It's really collaborative. Yeah. There's like a couple of my punchlines were given to me, you know, when someone watches you and goes, oh, this is a great tag, you know, just an extra thought on the joke you already had.
Yeah.
Have you thought, and then you just chuck it in and then off you go. Yeah.
So that's not... So what's outright stealing then? Is it just stealing other people's material? Does that happen?
It does happen. Yeah, yeah. Becky's stolen all my
material. What do you do? Like, can you
a monitor? Yeah.
It's
awkward. It's very taboo. It's
imagine.
I think there's a difference between, like, if you're doing something collaborative, like if your friend sits down and goes, oh, I've got this joke about, I don't know, Tyrannosaurus Rex's arms are too short. And then you're like, I'm sitting there going, like, well, I don't want to talk about this at all, but I'll help you think about it.
Oh, okay.
And like, yeah, and if I'm watching Becky, you know, Becky does a joke about her voice, you know, well, I don't have a voice like that. So if I think of a joke about it, then I might, you know, Becky might have, you know. And that's just how comics think. You know, we watch each other perform and we go, well, you're already talking about this. And what have you said this? You know, would that work? And, you know, so it's collaborative in that way. And stealing is just, when you watch someone else online or whatever. Yeah,
and you just change a couple of words. Yeah. And you go, no, it's different enough.
Yeah, but people, you know, get a reputation. And, and there is a New Zealand Comedy Guild. We have sort of a union, suppose. Yeah. And that's meant to address, you know, conflicts between comedians and things like that. So I guess we could, you know.
So if you fell out with someone about something like that, you stole my idea, the Comedy Guild would intervene and perhaps eject them from the Comedy Guild if they were found to be out of line? Has that ever happened?
They're not super powerful. They're a bit like the UN, you know? They're kind
of... But I'm aware that there are people, like, you know, maybe the Comedy Festival, for example, which is another organisation, or the Comedy Club, the Classic, you know, I think they have... I've heard that they've passed down, you know, maybe some consequences for people who've you know, stolen jokes or whatever. You know, like you can't gig for 3 months or something. You know, things like that I've heard have happened. And and it's also just, I think the other thing though is most comedians, you know, especially in New Zealand, almost no one does it. No. One is that we're at the scene so small that if you stole from each other, we'd be like, oh, we know, you know,
I've heard.
It's hard to hide.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And then the other thing is, I don't think most comedians find it rewarding to get up on stage and, you know, just read out somebody else's ideas. Yeah. You know, I don't think, you know, you...
That'd be acting.
Exactly, yeah. It's like acting, But like, you want to be funny, not, you know... Like,
it's also easy. It's difficult to approach someone and tell them you think they've stolen a joke because there is only so many jokes in the world. You know, there's only so many angles on certain things. And some things are just, like, commonly... sort of noticed as being funny, and so, and then also you watch so much comedy that sometimes people do just sort of subconsciously pick things up, and you know, you think you know, like when someone says something quietly, then someone repeats it louder, and they think they thought of it, but actually they just heard you say it.
Sure.
And so you kind of approach it like, oh, I don't know if you know that this is a bit I've seen.
Okay. One thing I was wondering is, like, I've talked to lots of the comedians who've come through, and I'm not saying you're all the same age, but where are the old comedians? Like, where are the people like my age?
The retirement homes.
But, like, there must be attrition rate must be quite high, or what happens? Like, who are the older comedians, like Di Henwood and, and those sort of guys who are maybe a bit older, but like, what about like geriatric comedians? Do they, do people stay funny when they get older or not?
Yeah,
like,
I think that also New Zealand comedy is quite new to New Zealand.
Really?
Like like even when Diane Paul and stuff were starting it, and Mike King and stuff, it was very different back then because people hadn't seen a lot of, you know, it kind of started in America and and then
comedy started in America.
Stand up.
I do feel like stand up is a quintessentially American art form. Like it's there's something about it that feels American to me, like standing up in front of a crowd and thinking you're important enough to like, that feels very American to me. But I do, I think
Becky, it wasn't the facilities, like the classics only,
twenty-five years old. So the comedy club in New Zealand is only 25 years old.
So it's very young. Yeah.
So most of the comics who started out, I think they often started, I think, just before the classic open. And so, so there just wasn't that, I guess, that pathway to become a professional. You know, 7 days is a relatively new show. And that's where a lot of comedians, you know, make money. Like, even and before when the classic opened, like, who was around? It was, like, Fred Dagg and Billy T. James. And they, I think they just did their own thing. You know, they were somehow able to put on their own shows and, you know, forge their own path. But there wasn't, like, a circuit around New Zealand. I just don't, I'm just not sure if it was an obvious thing for New Zealanders to do back in the day to become stand-ups. And then, and, yeah, like, I guess Fred Dagg, John Clark, he, I mean, he moved to Australia. And he, I guess he passed a few years ago, sadly. But I think that people do, I don't think they lose their funny bone. Like, I think so long as you stay gigging, you get out in front of crowds, you keep the muscle, you know, it's like it's like a muscle.
Comedy muscle.
If you keep working out, you know, I think you'll stay, you can stay strong forever.
And also when you've done a lot of TV and you're making TV money, you maybe don't feel the need to do live things as much.
This is like the hard yards going up in front of audiences.
So driving around the country and staying in random hotels.
Like if someone's got it working five
days. Away from your family.
Yeah, if someone's working 5 days a week in television, with the, and, you know, can go home and see their wife and kids and stuff, or their husband and kids, you know, you can... I can see why you wouldn't want to necessarily drive all the way out.
So it's probably a lifestyle thing that favours younger people as well.
Absolutely. And because also the arts are just a risky career as well. So I think it naturally draws young people. Whereas if you're, if you're, you've got a more established career, I can definitely, I could, it'd be very hard to suddenly go, I'm going to risk it all and become a stand-up comedian and, you know, can, you know, give up
all the... mortgage the house.
I want to tell jokes. So how did you guys end up working together? How did that happen? What's that? Is there a special affinity between you two in terms of comedy, or like, what's the sort of thing?
I don't know. We're just good friends and I think really enjoy each other's comedy. And then we didn't want to do an hour.
Have you ever done an hour?
Ray's done a lot.
I've done a few hours. And I'm sort of trying to, in preparation for next year's comedy festival, I'm trying to get some material together and stuff. And so this was me.
So what we saw last night, is that relatively new material?
It's it's all stuff written since the last comedy festival, I guess. I don't think I did anything before the previous comedy festival.
And do you enjoy writing? Like, is it, is it an enjoyable process?
Yes and no.
It's good when it's good. I'm so funny.
But you can have days when it's bleak.
But I'm someone who, I'm someone who very much has to sit down and write everything I'm going to say out word for word. I'm very planned. Some people aren't like that. Some people like to just go on stage with an idea and flesh it out. But I think I work best if I've got an idea of what I'm going to say.
So what you said last night was pretty scripted?
Yes.
Even though your delivery is the opposite, it's feels very...
Oh, good, good.
Feels very unscripted.
Yes, well, that's, I think that's the trick of being a good stand-up comedian, is
it doesn't sound too polished.
Exactly, yeah, and I think all comics, you know, you're trying... I mean, all comics have said their jokes before. Or nearly all of them, apart from the improvisers. And it's just a trick of making it feel fresh for the audience. That's one of the skills of being a, stand-up.
Because your stage persona, could we call it that, is somewhat sort of, you know, not incoherent, but like, you know, not the most... In person, you're much more articulate than you know...
Yeah, I'm more gregarious, maybe, a bit more energetic off stage than... I don't know how what you perceive me on stage, right?
Well, you come on in that suit, and you sort of... You're sort of awkwardness and sort of slightly, you know, and that's a persona, right? So is yours a persona as well, Becky?
I think mine is pretty much just me, isn't it? Like, I've had my flatmates come and watch me a few times, and one of them said, she's like, it's just like a Sunday in the lounge on the couch with you.
That's nice.
So, yeah, I don't know. Mine's kind of just,
yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Here I am.
Yes. Well, I think it's definitely like a heightened version.
Yeah.
But I think it started from when I first started stand up. I was so nervous to do it.
Right.
You know, the very first times I was performing, and I remember I couldn't stand looking at the audience, and so I just look at my feet the whole time. And I was just so. And I remember a woman came up to me afterwards, who was, you know, she worked in the scene, and she said, I know it's like part of your character, but I think maybe you should try looking at the audience. And I was like, I would look at the audience if I could. I
just, oh, really?
I just couldn't, the nerves got to me. And so I think it stems from that, the introvert nature of my performance.
Yeah.
It's sort of just how I started.
I saw you do that. There's been a video of you doing that thing about peeing in the shower, and I was like, oh my God, you know, like, that seems quite exaggerated, that sort of clip of you being like that. But anyway, it's 11 o'clock, so we better wrap this up so we can keep things timing right. So thanks very much for coming in, Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers. And your show tonight is at 7 p.m. at Fringe After Dark.
Yes.
And then, so you're not involved in the Dice Show.
Oh, I am.
Oh, you're doing it.
Yeah, I'll be on the Dice Show.
Great.
And then I think we're doing the comedy review.
The finale, Fringe comedy finale at 8:30. So will you both do a little spot?
Yes, in that? Yeah.
Great. Yeah, okay. Awesome. Well, it's been great having you up, and thanks for coming to Fine Day Fringe. Hope to see you next time. Not sure when it's going to be yet. Could be 2024. I think that's just because everyone's feeling tired. It's been really good fun, and great to meet you both.
Well, cheers, Dave.
Okay. Thanks.
Like, where'd you get that dope tracksuit from?
Yeah, every time I rock this shit, people bug out my tracksuit. Like, this shit is scratchy the fuck out. All of a sudden, there's a fucking line in my face. Dumb fuck with the camera right in my face. Dude's like,
look who's all up in the club with the onesie. Look at me, everybody, I'm in a onesie.
This fat fuck, mad drunk, or break shit. I'm just jealous on some fucking hater shit. Cell phone in my face, shouting loud as you can. So we snatch the fuck cell phone out his hand. Slip video must look fuck sick. When I stuck his phone in my pants, rubbed on my dick. Dude was dumbstruck. Handed the phone back to this dumb fuck. Motherfucker nearly had a heart attack. Now he flushed it. Tripping out all disgusted. I'm holding out his phone, but he doesn't want it back. It's like, fuck it. Pop his phone back to his pocket.
What's wrong with you, man? Fucking crazy?
I applied, yes, I'm totally fucking crazy. Gold teeth flashing, smiling, Alana, a little nana, trying to cool down the drama.
Fuck you up, man.
Tonight was a special night, now this fat fuck screaming like he wanna fight. So I said, you gonna bark all night, huh, little doggy? Or you gonna bite? Motherfucker still steaming, making a big scene, screaming as he get himself kicked out. He's peanut butter and jealous, peanut butter and jelly. Calling the Uber with the smell of dick on his celly.
We'll be right back.
We'd like for you to join us on this imaginary experience. Picture in your mind.
Thank you. Sounds so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He put one hand upon my head. Great God Almighty, let me tell you what he said.
Go tell that lonesome liar, hey. Go tell that midnight rider, hey. Tell the gambling, rambling backslider, tell him God Almighty gonna cut him down.
You might run on for a long time,
run on ducking and dodging,
run on children for a long time.
Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut you down.
You might run on for a long time,
run on ducking and dodging,
run on children for a long time.
Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut you down.
You might throw your rock, hide your hand,
yeah.
Work in the dark with your fellow man. Show as God made the day and dark,
yeah.
Dark from the light, running high, just slipping slide, trying to take a moat from your neighbor's eyes.
Yeah.
Show as God made you rich and poor, you gonna reap just what you sow. You might run on for a long time,
run on, duck and
ducking and dodging from no children for a long time. Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut you down. You might run on for a long time. Run on, ducking and dodging from no children for a long time. Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut you down. Some people go to church just to signify, trying to make a date with a neighbor's wife. Brother, let me tell you, just as sure as you're born, you better leave that woman alone, because one of these days, you mark my word, you think that brother is gonna wait. You go up and you knock on his door, that's all brother, you'll knock no more. You might run on for a long time. Run on, ducking and dodging, run on children for a long time. Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut you down. You might run on for a long time. Run on, ducking and dodging, run on children for a long time. Let me tell you, God Almighty gonna cut you down.
Radio. I'm Damien, just finishing my chocolate croissant. I hope you've enjoyed this morning so far. I've had great interviews with Advait Kartikar, who's from the Awkward Indian Guy Act. And then I had John Davies, whose show Tetupur the Goblin is on tonight at the Octagon at 8 o'clock. And after that,
Stephen Lyons came in to talk about the Dice Show and the Fringe Comedy Finale, which he's emceeing. And then finally, I had a very enjoyable conversation with Ray O'Leary and Becky Umbers, whose show, Your Money Back, is at 7 p.m. tonight at Fringe After Dark. Okay, so I'm just waiting to see if somebody from Blackadder is going to come in and have a chat. In the meantime, here is a song by Lamb Chop called, I love this song, In Care of 8675309.
The coast of the house that came to me. It was dimming soon, how the parts could fill in the room. Just the perfect end, and I wish we could pretend that tomorrow would be all that was a weekend. Designs that will connect to the fallen power of their offers and our plea. With your hands reached out, what replies allow to lie? Is there really too much to take with you? A question. Something out there for you to do.
toughest kinds of fruit. What has happened to the mind down at the fruit tree? The maize I rank in cheese, saving the day for all our cares, and I'm always so great. By the comments they bring, you can hear the echoes sing.
Sure. If I call you sugar, if you call me honey, does this mean you got a hand in my fate? If you take my money, if I take your liberty, does it mean it's all down the lane? If it open doors to me, I'll have the chance to respond.
And welcome back to Fringe Radio. Our last guest this morning is Harley Alexander, who's the president of the Kerikeri Theatre Company and the director of Blackadder the Golden Age, which is performing today at 116 at 5:30 p.m. and tomorrow at 116 at 3:30 p.m. And it's actually the show that closes out the Fringe. So welcome to Fringe Radio and welcome to 116, Harley.
Thank you very much.
I think your play has got the biggest cast of anything in the Fringe so far. How many people are there altogether?
We've got a cast of 15 and also five behind the scenes musicians and crew, so 20, right. 20, a troop of 20.
Wow. Yeah. That's quite a big operation to bring down to Whangarei.
It is. It's a bit of a challenge in terms of logistics. It's been very interesting, particularly with the nature of Fringe being pretty free for all, so it's going to be fun. It's going to be quite an experience tonight.
Yeah. So you're a theatre company. I'm assuming you're all sort of Kerikeri citizens who do this as a sort of this is a sideline.
Yeah.
This is not a professional theatre company.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kerikeri Theatre Company is we are a community group. And non-for-profit organisation as well. So we attract actors from all around the far north who love to perform. In fact, we've got Lucy Victory, who plays Queenie in our show, is from Hehe, and she's actually performed on the West End. She's
wow.
So she's a very experienced actor and fantastic voice as well. But she's fabulous as Queenie,
right?
Doing comedy.
Great. So, how long have you been rehearsing?
We've been going for about 3 months. And the way that we approached the rehearsal process was we really wanted the play to sound fantastic. So mm-hmm. we really focused on how the actors were speaking and having getting a real rhythm in the way that scenes run.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've just added the costumes as sort of the icing on the cake.
Right.
Yeah. So it's been a very interesting process. I think also all the actors have very good voices, and they were cast because they had good voices.
Right.
So there's... I guess we're paying homage to the original TV series 2, which has Flash Art and Prince Ludwig and all yep. those characters. And the way that the actors are approaching it is very much paying tribute to those original cast members.
In terms of not trying to do an original interpretation, sort of trying to replicate not
mimicking them,
uh-huh, right.
but definitely reminding audiences of the original. So,
right.
And they very much bring their own personalities into the role, which is what I was hoping they would do, and they do it very well.
So you started with a script, a finished script,
yeah.
And that's by Jason Fraser.
That's right.
Has this been performed elsewhere? Has it been...
Yeah, Jason actually lives in Invercargill. He's an Invercargill director, and he got the rights from the BBC to mash up the best episodes of Series 2,
right,
and create into a stage adaptation. And they performed it. I think it was the Invercargill Repertory Theatre performed it last year.
Right.
So yeah, we just asked Jason for his adaptation and cleared the rights. Through the Ben Elton and Richard Curtis's agent in the UK,
yeah,
and amazingly, the fee that we have to pay is actually really cool. It doesn't go to them. We pay £75 per show, and uh-huh. that goes to Comic Relief in the UK.
Wow.
So Ben Elton and Richard Curtis actually, you know, are giving away their royalty check.
And it doesn't sound like a huge amount of money anyway for the performance.
No, exactly. Yeah.
So you've been rehearsing for 3 months with such a big cast. It must be logistically complicated. You're rehearsing weekends and evenings? Is that the...
Yep, 3 times a week. Big rehearsal on Sunday. And I think really it was about working the scenes, getting them really, really tight.
Mm.
And so really the costuming and the set and everything was kind of bought in, not at the last minute, but it's an embellishment to what's already...
Right,
a very good sort of radio with pictures, I guess.
Yeah,
is a good way to describe it.
And the costumes look quite elaborate, quite era specific.
Absolutely, we've had a costume designer, a lady called Jenny Blackler, who has done an absolutely astonishing job with all the costumes. She's been working for months on them.
Right. She's made them all from scratch?
Made them all from scratch. Wow. And used a number of references, including the original TV show, as the reference. So the costumes just look fantastic.
Yeah.
So it's really... we're very lucky to have Jenny agree to do that for us.
Yeah. And I'm assuming everyone's sort of working on a voluntary basis in this...
Absolutely, yep.
Yep.
It's all community, the best of community theatre from Kirikiri.
Have you ever done anything this big before as a company?
We have. Last year we did The Sound of Music, which we put on at the Turner Centre in Kirikiri, and that attracted the most. We put on 9 shows, and it attracted roughly 3,500 people over the course of those performances. And for us, it was certainly the biggest show we've ever hosted, and also the Turner Centre's biggest show ever that they'd hosted as well.
Yeah.
So we gained a lot of fans from that from that show, and so we this year was Blackadder. We were going to stage Macbeth at the beginning of the year,
mm-hmm.
But due to COVID, our cast was wiped out by by the COVID bug, unfortunately.
So it wasn't lockdown, it was actual COVID.
It was right. COVID. It was some of the first cases up in the far north.
Right.
And unfortunately, it hit our cast. So we are looking to put on Macbeth in February
right.
Of this coming year.
At the Kainui Vineyard, it says in your program.
Correct, yep.
Is that a good venue for... Is it an outdoor?
It's an outdoor venue, yes. So you can sit out there and have a glass of wine and beer right. and pizza and enjoy summer Shakespeare.
So is it still provisionally booked for those dates, or is it... Are you pretty certain those...
The dates...
10th to the 19th of Feb?
10th to the 19th of Feb, yep.
That's,
that looks like it.
Great. So what's your background, Harley, in theatre? Like, what's your... Where do you...
I'm just a very keen amateur actor, but my background, my day job is I'm a video producer, so I've worked in television for over 30 years now, directing television programs and corporate videos, and so that's where my skill comes in.
Right.
This is actually my first attempt at doing a show.
A staged show,
yeah.
Well, how have you found it?
It requires a different set of skills. It's much more hands-on than I was anticipating. But
in the sense of what, giving actors direction for specific things you want them to do? Or?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm used to, as a TV director, you give your actors or your presenters direction all the time. I think what's been really interesting with this process is I've never had so many people I've had to direct. And normally it's just one or two people.
Yeah.
And you put the camera on them and you say, okay, I need you to sort of say that line a little clearer. Could you repeat that? But that bit was interesting.
Yeah.
But with the big cast, there are 15 very good actors, I'm very lucky in that I can give them direction and they remember it and they do it the next time, which is a dream for a director.
That's what you want. And they're all adults, I'm guessing. There's no children in the show?
We've got one of our musicians is a young Declan Matthews, who's, I think he's about 16, 17. Mm-hmm. So he's the youngest fella amongst us. But everyone else, we're all...
Seasoned performers.
Seasoned performers, yeah.
Great. So you've enjoyed the rehearsal process. You've found it an enjoyable thing. I guess that's important, isn't it? Because if it's hell, no one would do it.
That's right. And I think... that will come out in the performance. So when people come along and see it tonight and tomorrow here at 116, you'll definitely see that the cast are having a ball and really enjoy it. And we've run the show, I don't know, probably 30, 40 times, and every time we all end up in hysterics because it is very funny.
Right. So, yeah. Could you kind of sort of pricey the storyline for us a little bit? What's the storyline?
Yep, it's a mashup of the four episodes are Bells, which is where Blackadder gets married to a girl named Kate Bob, and a lot of confusion ensues.
Right.
There's also he owes money to the Bishop of Bath and Wells, and so he makes an appearance and threatens him with a red hot poker.
Right.
Then the other one, what have we got? Evil Prince Ludwig, which is the Chains episode, where he and Melcher get kidnapped and thrown into a dungeon and tortured by a very strange Spanish torturer. And when I say strange, you'll see what I mean when you come and see the show. It's very funny. The last one was Chains, Bells... Can't remember the last
so those
one.
All yeah. those storylines all sort of work together, and each one is resolved kind of
absolutely
dramatically.
And that's what Jason Fraser's done very well is with his adaptation is he's made the whole all those four episodes work as one narrative,
right?
And it does flow very well.
Mm. So that season had four episodes. Season two of Blackadder.
It had six.
Uh-huh.
But I think just because of duration, he had to decide to drop two.
Uh-huh.
So the show runs just over 2 hours, and then there's a break as well, interval in the middle.
Yep.
The actual narrative flow of it is very very engaging and works really well.
Right. So you've done 30 or 40 shows already. Was that in Kerikeri?
This is just in rehearsal.
Just to
run the show.
This is the first actual performance, tonight is the premiere.
Night number one, yeah. Cool. Well, New Zealand premiere, for sure.
That's exciting. So
And then after this, you're going to up to Kaitaia, is that right?
That's right, Kaitaia next weekend. And we've almost sold out both shows at the Te Ahu Centre there, which is great.
What's that like to perform at the Te Ahu Centre? Have you been there before?
We haven't actually performed there before, so it'll be an adventure. I think we might be like one of the first theatre companies for a long, long time to actually perform in there. It's in the little cinema. It doubles as a cinema when it's not being used as a theatre. But it's actually a really nice little space.
Smaller than here, or
just a bit smaller.
How many does the Turner Centre seat?
Turner Centre's, I think it's just over 400 at full capacity.
Right.
So we played the Turner Centre in Kirikiri, not this coming weekend, but the next weekend. So last weekend in October, and Saturday night there is sold out. Pretty much sold out, and Friday night's heading that way as well. So there are tickets still available for the Kitty Kitty show, highly recommend you jump in because they'll probably sell out as well.
So how many performances altogether this season?
The whole season is eight.
Eight,
two here in Whangarei, two in Kaitaia, and then four in Kitty Kitty.
And do you think there will be further performances? Like, do you imagine there will be, or
the cast are already saying, can we do more? I think we'll have to look at logistics and cast availability and things like that, but I'm sure if we put it to them, I'm sure they would.
So the Turner Centre is 400, and I'm guessing, you know, the Captain Bougainville Theatre could potentially be a venue for this sort of show, because that's about a similar size.
Did you
consider that? I mean, I don't.
We could, yeah. I mean, the reason we're in here at 116 is mostly because I think Fringe, that was the option given to us by Fringe. So, and it is actually quite good to start with a smaller crowd as well, especially for the first show.
Yeah.
Make sure everyone laughs in the right places.
For sure.
So, until we hit the big centre at the end of the month.
Right. So, great. That's wonderful. So there are still tickets available for today's show?
No, it was sold out. Sold out in Whangarei, yep. So
both shows are sold out?
Yeah, today and tomorrow, yeah.
That's really... that's great. That's wonderful, isn't it? So... Have you done much other stuff at Fringes? Have you been to other Fringe festivals yourself? Or
no, this is the first one I've been involved with.
Because they've just had Upsurge Festival up in the far north, haven't they? Where's that based?
They used a number of venues, including our own. We have the Black Box Theatre in Kirikiri, which is the Kirikiri Theatre Company premises, and they used our venue for four different events.
Mm.
We didn't actually have anything in the show itself, but we hosted it, hosted those other events. The Upsurge, I think they're keen to, do more. There's, they had to have a couple of years off because of COVID, and now they're back, which is great.
So you might have something for next year's Upsurge, because is it in August or September or?
September time, around that time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, because we've got the Black Box Theatre, we can do the smaller boutique kind of a bit more edgy type shows. We did one last year, which was through Jean O'Jacques and his wife Kashama Jane did a play called The Mother with the Hat. And that was pretty edgy, pretty fruity language, pretty strong subject matter, but sold out.
Really?
It was, there was an absolute appetite for it.
How many does the Black Box Theatre seat?
We can take up to 50 people total.
Right.
Yeah, so that's including cast, just because of fire regulations. Oh,
so you couldn't possibly perform this show there?
It'll be a very small audience.
Right.
But we could. I mean, we're looking to actually get our fire regulations, fire report done and a system put in so that we can have more people in the Black Box.
Is that part of the Turner Centre, the Black Box Theatre?
No.
It's a separate building, separate premises.
And
that's where you rehearse?
Yeah, we rehearse there and we lease it with... and it is a good space, but we regard it as an agnostic space. So if any other community groups want to use it, they can come in and use it as well. It's very basic, but it does the job.
Great.
It's actually very similar setup to what you've got here at 116.
Right. Yeah. So have you done your tech? Are you all set up?
We're all good to go.
Good to go. Wow.
Yeah. We've sort of squashed in between two shows, but it's going to be a bit of a scramble. But I think we're
getting your set in and out. So you're in between Alone and
Morgana's show.
Morgana's show. Yeah. Great. Well, it's been great talking to you, Harley. Thanks for coming in. Really glad that that you're here. It's great to have a local, relatively local theatre company. Part of Whangarei Fringe.
Awesome.
So, great to meet you and good luck for tonight's show.
Thank you very much, Damien. Cool.